This episode, Justice League America number 59 and Justice League Europe number 35, cover dated February 1992. Breakdowns, part 13 and 14. Hello, and welcome to the 59th episode of Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but guess what? I have brought along some friends. In fact, each episode, I invite two different guest hosts to help me tackle a couple of issues of JLI, and this time, they're really friends. I mean that this time. Well, we'll see. Anyway, we'll chat with my second co-host in a little bit, but my first co-host today has been a long-time supporter of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, going all the way back to the earliest days of the podcast. And this poor guy, I mean, he can't catch a break. He is a massive fan of Firestorm and DC Comics and Transformers. I mean, geez, this guy knows more about retcons and reboots than anyone I've ever met. And if I was a better podcast planner, I'd have had the guest rebooted and replaced halfway through the episode and call him like the post-crisis version or the Beast Machines version or whatever. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Mark Baker Wright, or as I like to call him, Mark Baker Wrong. Welcome to the Secret Sanctuary, Mark. Thanks for being here, buddy. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Mark and I were talking before we started recording. This is crazy. We have known each other online for 14 years, going all the way back to 2009 in my Firestorm blog, because we're both losers and like weird characters. But then we've known each other face-to-face since 2018, like 5 years. We hang out every year at the Doctor Who convention. I've met his lovely wife. I mean, when you hear better half, I mean, seriously, this is much better half. And this is the first time we've ever podcasted together. That blows my mind.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate you're taking a chance with this unknown quantity for what I'm doing the math must be your 100th guest.
I think you're right. You know, I'd have to take off my shoes to count properly, but I believe you are the 100th. You know, even if you're not, we're just going to call it. Congratulations. You're our 100th guest. You get to go home with a home game version.
I mean, you could have had a Chris Franklin or Rob Kelly, but you have to do it with me, so I'll take it.
Beggars can't be choosers is what happens here. But so we came up together with a mutual love of Firestorm. We both love the elemental version of Firestorm, which by 1992, by the way, when this Justice League comic's on the shelf, he's gone. He's out in space. You know, you and I are out there without a comic. So, you know, I will get to it in a bit, but I am curious how you got from Firestorm to Justice League. So that'll be an interesting jump. But before we do that, we probably need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI Podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode we'll select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library. And usually it's tied into that month's episode of issue of JLI in some way, shape, or form. And I picked Suicide Squad Casualties of War trade paperback. And it's probably not the Suicide Squad you were expecting. This is not the John Ostringer Suicide Squad. This is the Keith Giffen Suicide Squad, folks. I mean, Keith Giffen, it's been a long, hard month since we've lost him, but this is a great way to celebrate your love of him. If you've never read it, especially, this collects the Suicide Squad series, issues 1 through 12. That's the whole series, right? It was from 2001. It was so great. It came out in the aftermath of Our Worlds at War. Sergeant Rock is back as a general in modern day, leading the Suicide Squad. Or is he? Anyway, it's a great series. They pick up a bunch of villains. You get Deadshot, Killer Frost. Hey, there we go, Mark. Major Disaster, a Reactron, Blackstar, a whole bunch of other people. And it, for me, this series is like the perfect amalgamation of John Ostringer's Suicide Squad with the JLI. Because there are funny, genuinely funny bits in this series. And then it's also dark and scary and espionage and bad guys. And it's a lot of fun. So, written by Keith Giffen. Lots of different artists in this thing. Cover artist is Joe Sanchez, Paco Medina. Cover price is normally $29.99, but you can get it for 42% off. It's only $17.39. Now, since Killer Frost was in this, do you ever read this, Mark?
I'm afraid I didn't. The Suicide Squad's one of my blind spots.
You are a bad friend. I just putting it out there. So Killer Frost should hold that against you.
Well, I can only apologize.
I like to think I left you speechless. And that's probably the first time.
You did.
In 14 years, it's the first time. Like, yeah, it's a win. All right. Now, Mark, this is the part where I ask you, did you happen to bring an InStock Trades recommendation? Because if you didn't, I wouldn't be surprised. You tell me.
I did indeed. I'm recommending Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck, Treasure Under Glass, The Don Rosa Library, Volume 3, published by Fantagraphics. Fantagraphics' third complete book of Duck Epics by Don Rosa includes Treasure Under Glass, A Tale of Ships and Scoundrels, War of the Wendigo, which pits Scrooge and the Peewee-Gaw Indians against a profiteer, along with a quest for Kublai Khan's gold in Return to Xanadu. Presented in brilliant color and behind-the-scenes factoids, these Duckburg epics are getting the royal treatment at a bargain price worthy of Scrooge himself. All the stories and art all done by Don Rosa. There are different colorists from time to time. This edition also includes The Island at the End of Time, which, being focused on a single island, provides the loose connection I found to tie it to this issue of Justice League. But I confess I have another reason for promoting a Don Rosa collection. Not only is he one of the absolute greatest writers of the Disney Ducks since Carl Barks, but I had the privilege of learning 8th grade social studies from Rosa's wife, Anne. So his work always has a deep connection for me. And it's not the Kubert School, but I'll take what I can get.
It's amazing. That's wonderful.
This volume is 192 pages of Disney Duck goodness and was originally priced at $29.99, but you can get it through in-stock trades for only $14.99, a savings of 50%. I can't recommend this volume enough.
That is an awesome selection, and what a cool tie back to your own personal life. Wow, great choice, Mark. Thank you so much. So folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows, it, you know, requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI Podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW Podcasts. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI Podcast. Our thanks go out to Bill Beer, Chris Lewis, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Doug Adamson, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zemkowski, Roger Preet, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, and Symbol Pending, and a couple of more weirdos named Tim Price and Mark Baker Wright.
Never heard of them.
You had to bribe me to get on the show. I get it. All right. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. All right. Now, everybody, get out of the social media. Tag us at JLI Podcast on Facebook and on Twitter. You know, as I always say, it's about building a community of online fans around the show. I want to hear your thoughts on, you know, breakdowns coming up towards the end here, how silly and goofy Mark is, you know, whatever you want to talk about. I want to hear it. Tag us on social media and be part of the conversation. Now, speaking of being part of the conversation, Mark, as I said, this is 1992. Firestorm's gone. I mean, even War of the Gods is over, where we got a little, you know, a little snippet of him, right? We got like one panel of Firestorm. So how did you connect with JLI, and when did that happen?
Well, you got to go back in time a bit. I certainly remember watching the Super Friends cartoon when I was a kid, but I didn't really get introduced to comic books until I started getting the Transformers comic book. And even then, I didn't start quite at the beginning. My first issue was number 8, so it's about a year into the run, 1985. But once I started picking up the Transformers comic, I was introduced not only to the world of comic books, but specifically to the world of spinnerets. So I'd often go to my local grocery store and I'd look through the other comics that were on the spinner racks at the grocery store, and I noticed a few things. One of the first things I noticed was this thing called Crisis, where I recognized several of the characters I knew from Super Friends. I can't honestly say I understood everything that was going on, but it was clear things were changing, and it soon became evident that several characters were getting great jumping on points for people like me. I also noticed this book called Who's Who, and I learned that there were like multiple versions of some of the characters I knew from the Super Friends cartoon, including some like Green Lantern, Flash, that clearly predated the versions I was more familiar with. So in essence, although the Transformers title that really brought me in, that was published by Marvel, I really became much more of a DC fan. Now, you've noticed that this time frame puts me squarely at the end of the original Justice League run. You usually refer to it as the Detroit era. Woo-hoo. So the sad fact is, I didn't really notice the JLA all that much at the time, because unlike Crisis and Who's Who, that version of the JLA didn't really have any characters I knew anything about. So I still looked at it in the spinner racks whenever it came out, and I did happen to notice at the end of issue 257, there's a splash page of a somewhat beaten up Firestorm. That caught my interest because I liked Firestorm. I was already starting to pick up the occasional issue of his series at the time. Anyway, so that issue of JLA was one of the lead ups into the Legends crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made pretty clear that that title was about to end, since Crisis had already prepped me to know that things were being given a new start. I was ready a few months later, not surprised to see that there was a new Justice League title, complete with that distinctive cover of the new team staring up at the reader. But when I looked through that issue at the store again, I didn't see all that many characters I was familiar with. I did take note of the frame where Batman tells a reporter to get the camera out of his face. but honestly, beyond that, I didn't think to follow the title more seriously because I didn't recognize those characters as well. So I kept following the DC Universe kind of loosely, certainly Firestorm more seriously, a bit of Superman, occasional crossover event keeping me a bit on the pulse of the DC Universe. But I didn't really follow this title until your podcast.
Whoa. And
so, you know, following it from the first episode and kind of just reading along as the podcast episodes are coming out, I have since come to love the humor and the interplay between the characters that were featured in the comic. But I'm really sorry to say I never really even noticed it that much when it was coming out. So my history is really quite new.
That's interesting. I love the idea of chatting with you as we go through this and getting your perspective as coming at this as, you know, someone 30 years later, someone that didn't have it ingrained in them. Now, you still read it in real time, though. I mean, across what, 7 years in theory. I mean, you may have read ahead, right, or whatever, but experiencing it in as an adult, it's got to be a completely different sort of thing. Wow.
Yeah, no, and actually, I really haven't read it ahead. So what happens after the issue we're going to talk about today, I'm still in the dark about.
Oh, okay. Well, you're going to get a couple of spoilers probably for at least the JLE, which is on the other half of this episode. But beyond that, you should be in the clear.
I'll feel safe to read it once we've stopped recording.
There we go. So I got to say, looking at your history and what I know about you, Mark, which is sadly far too much, but coming in through Crisis is probably the best possible thing for you as a Transformers fan could have had ramping up, because Transformers, it seems like every 30 seconds, has an entirely new reboot of continuity. So the fact that you came in through Crisis, which gives a whole new continuity, probably prepped you for a life of misery and change.
You know, Transformers didn't actually start doing that for another 10 years. It was old hat to me by the time they really started getting into that problem.
Well, nowadays, every time you turn around, it's like, oh, look, it's Energon. It's Beast Machines. It's I don't even know the names anymore. I had my era. But you'd be very proud of me, by the way. I bought Transformers 1-4 off the spinner rack. Or, no, 1-5, because that famous Shockwave cover, number 5. I bought the first 5 issues off the spinner rack.
You actually beat me, because like I said, I didn't really get started until number 8.
I still don't. I have no idea why I bought them. I don't have a clue. I guess I knew about the cartoon. I don't know, but it attracted me, that great painted cover in number 1. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. So let's get into this. So folks, you can follow along. Go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. We'll have a gallery post out there. We'll post some of the images from this issue. Not all of them. I mean, the fact is, folks, you can find this issue on DC Unlimited. You can go buy a floppy copy. You can buy it on Comixology. Yeah, the third omnibus is going to be coming out before you know it. So, I mean, all of this is going to be there. So I'm not going to post a lot, but enough for you to get a sense of what we're talking about. And this is Justice League America number 59, published by DC Comics, cover dated February 1992, on the shelves December 17th, 1991. Cover price is $1, 4 shiny quarters. The cover is by, it's by Kevin Maguire and Terry Austin. Oh my gosh! The original team from JLI number 1 back together again. Unbelievable. Mark, you want to describe the cover for us?
Sure thing. This is one of those deals where anybody who's over a certain age probably has seen a scene like this in cartoons, although anybody younger than a certain age who somehow never managed to watch one of those old cartoons may be less familiar with the gag, because it's almost certainly the kind of thing that isn't going to pass muster in a more modern entertainment.
Are you calling me old?
I'm calling myself old.
Fair.
We're in the middle of what looks to be a jungle setting. Martian Manhunter and Blue Beetle are front and center, sitting in a large pot as we see a dark-skinned arm coming in from off-panel to light a fire beneath the pot. Clearly, we are meant to understand that our heroes are about to be cooked by cannibals. In the background, we see Metamorpho and Power Girl hanging with their arms and legs tied to wooden frames, presumably for easy transfer to the pot once Manhunter and Beetle have been boiled themselves. prominent just below the title logo is a word bubble where Martian Manhunter presumably does his best Oliver Hardy impression to Beatles Stan Laurel as he said, "Well, here's another fine mess."
So I absolutely love the ludicrousness of this cover. It's hysterical. And you mentioned Laurel and Hardy, right? But I mean, if you, and you mentioned certain frame of time and everything, because you think about it, Laurel and Hardy are popular there from like the 1920s and the 1950s. So this is 1991. We're talking either, you know, 40 to 70 years later, which is insane. But you and I would know them because of all the TV replays, right? In the 70s,
they were doing
80s.
Reruns all the time. Yeah,
exactly. And this gag of, and they don't even, by the way, they don't even finish the line. It's, "Well, here's another fine mess you've gotten me into, or got us into." I can't remember exactly, but they don't even finish.
"Here's another fine mess you've gotten me into, Stanley." And you could just kind of imagine Oliver Hardy is kind of fiddling with this tie.
Yes. And it's fun because like he doesn't even have to finish the line and we know how it ends because we grew up seeing all that. So yeah. So as you're saying though, this is something we probably wouldn't see in modern day. That's fair.
Well, there's just kind of an obvious tone of racism that's in the image, and it's actually made worse by the fact that while on the cover, the arm that's about to light the fire is dark-skinned, if you actually read the issue, all the Kui-Kui-Kuians are kind of white-coated.
So I will tell you, I'm reading the physical copy and the version on DC Unlimited. I don't know if you've, or DC Infinite, whatever it's called.
And I have both of them.
The colors are much, much, much brighter on the digital version, to the point where the arm, it's still darker, probably to look more like maybe a Pacific Islander kind of skin tone rather than an African-American or something like that. But it's still coding natives. So yeah, this it probably wouldn't pass muster. But at the time, you know, it was a... I don't know if I want to say harmless, but there was no ill intent intended.
Certainly not.
It, they were just going for a gag, you know, really is what they're trying to do.
Absolutely.
So, you know, because obviously, I mean, the gag here, you know, Martian Manhunter, Power Girl, Metamorpho, all of them could clearly escape this situation. Yeah, Blue Beetle, maybe not so much, but it's definitely just supposed to be for laughs. And it, politically incorrect or not, I find it pretty funny myself. Like, this cover is genuinely funny to me.
Well, yeah, this is obviously something that doesn't take place in the issue itself, but you get the idea of where they are and that they're in trouble.
And the faces, I mean, because it's Kevin McGuire, of course. So the faces on Martian Manhunter and Blue Beetle are absolutely fantastic. And you get great representation, too, because like they've done this on some covers where we've got two Justice League America members and two Justice League Europe members. So you get a nice balance there. And again, I am a sucker for a word balloon on a cover. I have said that a thousand times in this show. I love it. And again, the fact that he doesn't even finish the line and we know what it is, it just brings me so much joy.
We have everything we need. Now, you talked about their expressions, and this is one of my kind of blind spots when it comes to comic books, because I listen to a lot of you guys, and you have so much knowledge about art and technique and such, and it's not something I've got the same appreciation for, but one thing I actually did notice looking at this cover, at the pot, there's like this little bubble of light on the left-hand side of the pot that takes what could just be a flat black space, and it gives it the sense of dimensionality, so that even though it's a 2D image, we intuitively know this is a round, almost spherical object.
That's a great observation. I didn't even notice that without you saying so. You're right. It really does help set the three-dimensionality of it. That's really clever. And there's other things, too. Like, the coloring in general is really expertly done on this. Like, you know, because Martian Manhunter's green, Blue Beetle's blue, and a color that naturally contrasts with those very well is orange. And you've got you've got a very strong orange background, which also looks nice against the forest green. So all of that really, really works well together. And the logo is blue and yellow, which contrast nicely together. It's a colorful cover. It balances really nicely. Visually, that pot, even though it creates a lot of black space and takes up a lot on the cover, it almost disappears. You don't even focus on it. You focus on the color rather than the black space. And it's a total win, I think this cover is.
Yeah, it tells you everything you need to know.
And it's funny. And this particular issue is not very funny. So, I mean, there's some jokes in here, but it's a darker tone because, you know, we're heading towards a penultimate moment. So they take it a lot more seriously this time. So it's nice to start with a joke.
Absolutely. And we'll be talking about the humor aspect of it later, I know.
Yeah. So let's get into this. So Plots and Layout is by Keith Giffen. Now, according to the words here, it is Writ and Wit by J.M. DeMatteis. Penciler is Bart Sears. Oh my gosh, Bart Sears. Inker is Randy Elliott and John Beattie. Letter is Bob LePan. Colors is Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor is Kevin Dooley. And editor is Andy Helfer. This is Breakdowns Part 13, 13 people of 15. We are almost at the end. Oh my gosh. And the story itself is called X Factor, with an E rather than, so it's not quite the Marvel title, but it's close. Mark, you want to start us off with a recap?
Absolutely. So our story begins in the secret sanctuary, where the Beefeater, accompanied by Inspector Camus, confronts Martian Manhunter about the situation regarding Max Lord, who we now understand to have been revived by and possessed by Dream Slayer. Catherine Colbert confirms these suspicions by reporting that Blue Beetle was unable to safely locate Mitch Wacky in Florida, and further has discovered that the JLA transporter tubes to Kui 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 are no longer in operation. When the Beefeater asks about their next move, Manhunter reminds him that he was simply the bureau chief of a bureau that no longer exists, that Beefeater is not a superhero, and that he is most certainly not a member of the Justice League. With Camus' help, Beefeater is escorted out of the story, kicking and screaming about Parisian bullies. With that annoyance out of the way, Manhunter and Catherine recognize that the team is about to go to war, and that this is going to be far, far worse than the situation they just survived with Despero. We shift scenes to witness Guy Gardner, still suffering from his injuries, complaining to Major Glory that he's really fine and ready to go into battle, despite his ring arm being held in a sling. Major Glory placates Gardner by offering to bring him comic books and cookies, but seems not to hear Gardner's request for more adult fare. At the same time, we witness Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress discussing Dream Slayer. While Jay tries to remain positive, Sorceress despairs that this battle may not be winnable. This brings us to the island of Kui Kui Kui, where Dream Slayer, in the bodily form of Maxwell Lord, exposits for the benefit of the audience, if not his mind-controlled minions, about his defeat at the hands of Silver Sorceress the last time they fought, and how his bodiless essence found healing in the alternate dimension of his origins before returning to our Earth to learn not only of the fate of the other extremists, but the current situations of the Justice League and Maxwell Lord. Dream Slayer then relates how he used Max's powers, even while still seemingly comatose, to control Mitch Wacky all the way in Florida to steal parts to repair the extremists and take them and himself to Kui Kui Kui. Dream Slayer also remotely controls the apparently weak-willed Wally West, don't tell William Messner Loebs, to steal security codes to free the extremists themselves while traveling at super speed, to have them shipped to Kui 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 and Mitch Wacky. Dream Slayer is now ready for Silver Sorceress and the Justice League. En route to Kui 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 in Beetle's bug, Beetle complains that he doesn't like the idea of going against Max. While Blue Jay tries to remind Beetle that it isn't really Max, Beetle's having none of it, since there's a real possibility that the only way to stop Dream Slayer is to kill Max's body. The other Leaguers present discuss the fact that they know they're walking into a trap, but that they have no choice but to be prepared for anything and to do their best.
Well, I'll take it from here. So Maxwell Lord, or Dream Slayer, yeah, I'm going to keep using that shipping name of Dream Slayer Lord. So Dream Slayer Lord watches the League arrive and orders the Kui 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 citizens to, quote, kill, kill, kill. The Justice League lands on the island, and Jean orders Blue Jay to take a look around the island because, let's face it, he's Blue Jay. Then the mind-controlled natives of Kui 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 attack. The Justice League knows they're not in control of their actions, so they try to avoid hurting the natives, which isn't really easy, considering the natives are trying to murder our heroes. Silver Sorceress and Martian Manhunter sense Dream Slayer's presence, so the team takes to the air to avoid having to fight the natives, and they confront Dream Slayer Lord. Their former leader turned evil warlock taunts our heroes, especially Silver Sorceress, who he hates for what she did to him in the previous battles. Shockingly, Dream Slayer Lord arranges for Silver Sorceress to be shot in the stomach by an arrow. She's grievously wounded and unable to use her magic against Dream Slayer Lord. Before the rest of the League can attack, Dream Slayer Lord explains his insidious plan. If the League does not surrender, all of the natives of Kui 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 will kill themselves obediently with one mental push from Dream Slayer Lord. Martian Manhunter has no choice but to surrender. Now, back at the Secret Sanctuary, Batman arrives. Oh yeah, that guy who helped found this incarnation of the League finally shows up in Breakdowns Part 13 to 15. Thanks, Batman. So Batman chats with Catherine Colbert, Ralph and Sue, Guy Gardner, and then suddenly the Secret Sanctuary is invaded by Dream Slayer Lord's new minions, the new extremists. And this mentally controlled villain team consists of some of the League's most powerful members, including Martian Manhunter, Power Girl, Rocket Red, Fire, Blue Beetle, Blue Jay, and Metamorpho. Oh, and They're all dressed in ridiculous loincloths and coconut brassieres, but that's a discussion for later. The last page sees Dream Slayer Lord monologuing over the dying form of Silver Sorceress. Next, in Justice League Europe, the showdown with Dream Slayer. Then in Justice League number 60, it's history in the making. Be here for the end of the old era and the beginning of the new. Yep, it's Giffen and DeMatteis' Swan Song. Ooh, so that is a lot, Mark. What'd you think, buddy?
Oh, this was fun. We'll just start right at the beginning. You know, for all of Beefeater's posturing and complaining, it's worth noting he never even lifts a finger to use any of his supposed powers or even his not going to be sued by Starman, no sir, cosmic rod against the Parisian bully of Inspector Camus, much less Martian Manhunter. He's truly all bark, no bite.
Well, I gotta ask, so is Martian Manhunter being unfair to Beefeater? Because like Beefeater's like ready to go and fight, right? And Martian Manhunter's like, back off there, you know, John Cleese, you're not even part of the team. But if you look back at the last battle with Despero, you know, Beefeater, he tried to fight Despero himself like twice in that battle. And that's a real testament to him. Even though they make fun of him in here for it, to me, I was like, dude, he's the real deal. So I don't know. What do you think?
It's hard for me to be too sympathetic to Beefeater because he's just a jerk. But you're absolutely right. He did put himself in harm's way. His bravery cannot be questioned. But it's that kind of bravery where, quite bluntly, he probably causes more trouble for others by putting himself in a situation where they have to be distracted and go rescue him. So again, I'm not really all that sympathetic.
Yeah, he is responsible for the destruction of the Paris embassy. So, I mean, that is...
I'm sure nobody has forgotten that.
Yeah, well, Power Girl certainly has, and she called him on it not too long ago.
Back at page 7, Dream Slayer is kind of doing this flashback where it's strictly for our benefit. I mean, the mindless minions, they don't care.
Right.
But when they show us his original body being destroyed, I have to admit this, I had some confusion at first, because when he says that his body's being destroyed by Silver Sorceress, I'm looking at that line art and I'm seeing that as Crimson Fox. So I actually looked up the reference to JLE number 19. Turns out it's not a mistake. And in fact, as I'm sure everyone but me remembered, Silver Sorceress took the form of Crimson Fox during that battle to provide an element of surprise, enabling the very moment we're seeing recreated here. Whether they were able to maintain that continuity because Bart Sears drew both issues, or whether it was because Keith Giffen wrote both issues or did the layouts, you know, so he had that hand in guiding things and simply wanted to make sure that we remembered it. Either way, whether it was good editorial guidance or whatever, I love that even in this era, before the internet gave us easy access to back issues, something that was probably forgotten or just kind of blipped over by most readers, they kept it constant. They kept the continuity.
I didn't even notice it until I read it in your notes and then looked. I'm like, oh, it is Crimson Fox. And I did instantly remember the story because, you know, I covered it on the show. But I'm willing to bet it was Bart because, I mean, the Extremis story and the Starro stories were probably his kind of like biggest epics that he did on Justice League Europe because each one was, you know, several issues long. And I mean, he's got to remember that thing. I mean, when he and I talked, he talked quite a bit about the Extremis stuff. So I bet he remembered. I bet that's where it came from.
Yeah, no, I all credit to him for that because it's a niggling detail, but it's the kind of thing us nerds love.
Oh yeah, it's great. So since we're talking about that whole Dream Slayer monologue thing, so I got a couple thoughts on this. So first of all, he mind controls Wally West, right? And yep. you called it in your recap, you know, would you say William Messner Loebs will be unhappy that he called him weak-willed? I thought the same thing. Like, I'm like, whoa, okay. So I didn't like that they called Wally weak-willed. And also, I think it's pretty funny. I guess he's wearing Fruit of the Loom underwear. Is that where we're supposed to look? Because he's got
I'm trying really hard not to think about what he's not wearing.
He's wearing, you know, what looks like a Speedo, right? But it's got like grapes and apples. And all this, I got to assume that's supposed to be some sort of like 90s Fruit of the Loom or something.
It made me think of the Todd from Scrubs.
I haven't seen enough Scrubs to know that, but I know I didn't wear underwear like that in the 90s myself, though.
The Todd's most noteworthy feature is wearing Speedos at every opportunity, and it's quite hideous.
Hey, if you got a power move, use it. So I also think it's interesting that Dream Slayer is the one who's responsible for healing Max, not, you know, like natural healing. So because when Max got shot last time, all the way in back like issue I don't know, whatever it was, 8 or 9, I don't remember. Metron's computer, I can't remember what it was called, the construct maybe, whatever. Anyway, Metron's computer healed Max from those gunshot wounds too. So it's almost like, you know, Max is never going to heal on his own. It's always going to be a bad guy that heals him. I guess that's his shtick.
It may well be. And of course, you know, up until now, Max really could only control like maybe the person right in front of him, and it gave him a nosebleed whenever he did so. I can't help but wonder if this is enabling that thing that we insist never actually happened in the lead up to Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
Oh, God. I didn't think about that. Thanks, Mark. Oh.
It didn't happen.
Well, okay. I mean, you make a lot of sense, though. I mean, that the logic there does track. Except, well, either way, the logic tracks that Dream Slayer made him more powerful. Huh? That could make a lot of sense. All right.
Thanks, Dream Slayer.
I'm sure Ted Kord feels the same way.
But he got better.
That's true. He did, didn't he?
We could be thankful for the multiple continuities and reboots for at least one thing.
There we go.
So what do you think, Shag?
Lots of things. I think lots of things all the time, Mark. What are you implying? So as far as, you know, just big things from the story, you know, one of the big points they make is, you know, they're getting ready for the battle, right? And Martian Manhunter says that this battle is going to be worse than fighting Despero. Or really, Catherine asks him, and he says, yeah, this is going to be worse than fighting Despero. And I got to wonder, you know, is that right? Is this battle worse than fighting Despero, the guy who basically tears apart all of, you know, downtown New York? I mean, I guess an argument could be made about the personal connection to Max, so maybe there's an emotional, you know, toll that it's going to take. But I don't know. Do you feel like this is worse than a Despero battle?
Here's the way I'm thinking about it. There's no question but that Despero is this powerhouse of rage. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's a blunt instrument. He doesn't really think about what he's doing except hate, 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 revenge, 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 and destroying whatever he can in the process. But Dream Slayer is manipulative. Mm-hmm. He thought through how to make the Justice League get into a situation that they can't win. So he's perfectly willing to take all of these mind-controlled minions and throw them at the Justice League. And then if it even seems for a moment that the Justice League might win, stop everything, grab some knives, hold it to your own throat, and now he's threatening to kill all these innocent people unless the Justice League surrenders. And that's how Dream Slayer wins this battle. It's not the rage-filled powerhouse that Despero provided, but it's far more insidious.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I will agree with that. What's his end goal, though? And now, I'm going to feel really stupid if it's right here on the page and I didn't pick up on it. But, like, what's Dream Slayer Lord's end goal here? Is he thinking he's going to take over the world? Or is he just getting revenge on the Justice League? Because I don't remember him saying he's going to take over the world.
The very last page, he actually talks about, this world will be mine.
Oh, well, see, it's right there on the page. Okay.
And honestly, this is the kind of supervillain that I don't even think he cares all that much about ruling. He cares about destruction. He will utterly destroy this world, just as he utterly destroyed the universe's Earth. I forget the name of it, what the actual planet's called.
Angor.
Angor, thank you. How he destroyed Angor. And then once this one's been all used up, he'll presumably move to some other universe, because we now know that he can, and just do the same thing all over again. Just destruction, destruction, destruction.
All right. That's fair. All right. So in theory, then, he could be a bigger threat than Despero in that regard, because he could destroy the whole planet, where Despero is going to destroy, you know, large chunks of it, but the human race might keep going. This guy's going to take it all out, and then he's going to take out the next parallel Earth, and the next parallel Earth, et cetera, et cetera. All right.
He is absolutely one of the most dangerous foes this Justice League ever fights.
Okay. All right. Then this does make sense as a penultimate, or ultimate, really, villain for the Breakdown Saga. So that works. Which, you know, if you're just reading Justice League America and never read Justice League Europe, you're probably scratching your head about who the heck the extremists are. But, you know, at this point, you're hopefully reading both books, I would hope. So you're picking up enough of the pieces to understand what's going on.
Yeah, and honestly, with the other extremists, up till now, if you didn't read the first one, you're not even getting all the Marvel Comics references, because they barely show up.
Right, and does this even, you know, I'm not a Doctor Strange guy, but at this point, does Dream Slayer even feel like Dordamu? Am I saying that right? Does he even feel like Dordamu anymore? I don't even know.
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. Sorry, I got several other like just quick things that are either callbacks or acknowledging things. Like, I like that Guy Gardner's beat up with injuries. I like that we're seeing the consequences of his battle with Lobo. You know, that's good because you don't always see, a lot of times they have a fight and they just walk away, whereas Guy was, they had the mess beat out of him last issue. So glad to see this.
He's really lucky to have gotten away with so little.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I love that Maxwell Lord is talking to Herb from the Cooey Cooey Cooey. That's a great callback for those of you who remember Herb, the idiot nephew of the chief. Then Dimitri. I like that Dimitri's the one who catches Silver Sorceress after she takes the arrow in the gut. And it's a Justice League Europe teammate. You know, that's kind of cool. I like the continuity of that, that a friend is there for him. That's good. And nice that Batman finally bothered to show up. That's a pleasure. I was wondering where he was through all of this, right? I mean, all his friends are falling apart. The team's falling apart. And even in this issue, he's like, they're fine. They've been through worse. And I'm thinking, really? Have they? I don't know.
And let's face it, this is a title where we've seen a few times where a character who was once part of the team just kind of disappears for issues on end, and we don't necessarily think about it until they show up again. I mentioned Crimson Fox earlier. How long has it been since we've seen her in an issue?
Only an issue or two. It hasn't been too long. She's definitely been in breakdowns, but yeah, she's nowhere near.
Yes, I remember just after the United Nations shut things down, she seemed to be around. I don't think I've seen her since.
I have to go back and look. I felt like she was in the battle with Lord Havoc, but maybe I'm imagining that.
She might have been in that.
I don't know. Interesting. Okay. So speaking of minor characters that don't get enough screen time, so Silver Sorceress, right? So she doesn't get enough screen time. She never does. And I feel like she gets some really good character moments in this. And in fact, Bart Sears draws her beautifully. I mean, she just looks beautiful in this. She looks tired, but she still looks beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad that after such a long time, they took the time to give her more screen time. And clearly, it's not just some common storytelling tactic where they get us to care for a character right before they... Oh, you don't want any spoilers, do you? Okay, never mind. Let's just move on.
I've said already, I actually have not read ahead, so I don't know if she dies or not, but I read this issue. It's like, I don't see how anybody comes back from that.
Let's put it this way. Have you ever seen the Silver Sorceress in anything else after this?
Well, I hadn't seen Blue Jay before anything else either, so.
That's because he's Blue Jay. all right, so I got to talk about some art stuff. So first off, Bart Sears. It's so exciting having Bart Sears in this book. And you know, we talked before in previous issues, you know, we had Chris Wozniak on the issues for quite a while. But it's Bart Sears, man. I'm so glad he's on I guess you could call it the premiere book. I mean, I guess Justice League America is the premiere book. So nice to see him here. I love the way he draws Martian Manhunter's eyebrow ridge. I mean, he's just so thick. It looks awesome. And with Catherine Colbert, first of all, he kind of created her look. So he knows what he's doing when he's drawing her, right? And he made sure that she had enough time to go raid a closet for business attire or, you know, whatever you might want to call it, a power pencil skirt or something. I mean, she's dressed to the nines for a business meeting in this thing. And I'm like, all right, you go, Catherine.
Always.
And it's interesting that when he draws someone like, you know, Martian Manhunter is this huge, chunky guy, right? But then he draws General Glory a lot more subdued, a lot more classical approach. And I got to think that's intentional because, you know, Bart does, you know, what is it, Brutes and Babes or whatever.
Yes.
Wizard thing. So to see him draw General Glory a lot more reserved has got to be intentional, sort of a nod to the classic era, which I thought was really clever artistic intelligence when he's doing that. I thought that was really good.
Well, especially for a scene where, even though we know from other appearances, General Glory is perfectly capable of handling himself in a fight. That's not the purpose he's serving here. Mm-hmm. He's serving a purpose to actually calm down a guy who wants to go fight and say, you're not being helpful here. You're not ready.
That's one of the things I love about the General Glory Guy Gardner relationship too, is no one can talk Guy off the ledge like him. Not even Ice, I would say, can talk him off a ledge to be more respectful or to be calmer. And maybe he's grumbling under his breath about some porn mags, but he's toeing the line because the general told him to.
Yeah. And Guy, for all of his bravado and just plain rudeness, there is something about how he feels about General Glory that no matter how much he may want to do something different than General Glory does, he will always back down for General Glory.
Yep. And some people don't like General Glory in the Justice League, but folks, I got to tell you, he's a fantastic foil for Guy Gardner. I mean, he really adds so much layers and depth to that character that I'm so glad they added him to the team. You know, I really am.
Somebody who can keep Guy Gardner in line without having to punch him in the face.
he's the Rob Kelly to me of the Justice League, so that works. Okay.
And yes, I specifically said that in a way that you didn't have to add the edit.
Thank you so much. That sound effect kills me. So if you jump forward to page 13, there is a great panel, and I don't think these words have ever been uttered together in a sentence. There's a great panel that makes Blue Jay look really cool. The third panel, Bart Sears made Blue Jay look really badass. And I'm like, wow, that has never happened before. And probably never will again, other than the Who's
Who
entry. And
then the very next frame, he's almost speared by an arrow.
Right, exactly. But he just looks so cool. So good on you, Bart. I'm impressed. I love that. And then something that just makes me laugh. So on page, 16, Power Girl, they're fighting the natives, right? They're fighting the natives, and they're trying to be careful. And actually, I think I got my page numbers wrong. It's page 14. Sorry. Anyway, Power Girl asks John, she's like, can't we just toss the natives around a little bit? And he's like, no. Well, what's fun is in the art, she's already tossing a dude. So it's just.
Yep. Very clearly.
Made me laugh. And of course, you get a big old butt shot because Keith Gibbon loves a butt shot of a fire in that one. But it's a fun panel. Now, here's something, too. Like, as I was reading it, you know, we've got two inkers on this issue. We got Randy Elliott, who's traditionally Bart Sears' inker. And then you've got John Beattie, who has been traditionally, at least in this series, Derek Robertson's inker. And you can distinctly tell the switch. Right around page 14, 15, 16, it really changes. And then from 16 on, it's not unrecognizable as Bart Sears, but there's a distinct difference between the first half of this issue and the back half of this issue. Did you notice this as well?
I'm afraid I don't. That's where I just don't have the eye for it that a lot of your friends have.
Okay. All right. Well, page 16 is the one that jumped out at me. Like when a Silver Sorceress earlier in the issue was just beautiful, just stunning. And here it's like, oh, not so much anymore. And that's when I started noticing like, oh, wow, these pages look really different. So you folks, you'll see it in the gallery as well. Right there at 14, 15, 16, that's where the transition happens. It's not bad. It's just different. And I just think that maybe Randy Elliott, I love John Beattie's an anchor. Let me put that out there. John Beattie's an amazing anchor. He does stuff with blacks and shadows and dark lines that will blow your mind. But I just think that maybe Randy Elliott, and I'm assuming that's who did the first half, is perhaps a little bit better for Bart Sears, you know, really incredibly detailed line work.
So do we need to talk about that second to last page?
Yes, we do. All right, so the new extremists, right, which is our mind-controlled friends. You know, this is our heroes. This is Martian Manhunter and Power Girl and Metamorpho. You know, the whole team that went to Kui Kui Kui. They are now mind-controlled. They're the new extremists, and they are all dressed in loincloths and coconut brassieres. And I'll put it out there first. I am, unfortunately, not a fan of this look. And, folks, you know I love the JLI, right? You know I love Bart Sears. I just don't like this gimmick. Even when it first came out, I didn't like this gimmick. And frankly, that's okay. You know, not every joke has to land for every person. So this one doesn't land for me, but I'm sure it does for other folks. How do you feel about this this look of theirs?
I like you. I'm not really a fan. And one thing that kind of just strikes me as I see this, you are, of course, fond of commenting on the, we'll just call it the hotness of some people on the team.
Hold on, let me just defend myself a second. I am very appreciative of the female form and the female brain, the whole package. So, to be fair.
Well, this is easily the best example I've seen in a long time to demonstrate that simply taking away clothing is not synonymous with being hot. Because these are characters that are usually quite good looking in whatever they're wearing. And here it's just kind of repugnant.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It like you said, Power Girl. Yeah, she's wearing something out of Gilligan's Island, right? And it doesn't increase the attraction. I see now they even went to the effort of giving her new earrings, which is sort of interesting that, you know, she's famous for those big earrings she wears. Now she's got different big earrings. So, yeah, it's not my favorite.
Dimitri at least managed to avoid the curse. I mean, he's still wearing his suit.
True, which is surprising. But, yeah, I would love to – and Fire as well. I would love to hear, folks, if you at home have a different opinion of this and you really like this look and think it's a lot of fun. And if you do, that's awesome. And I'm thrilled. It just didn't work, obviously, for me or for Mark. And we're the ones on the episode, so sorry. You got to suck that up. So there's a couple other things like the letters column announces who the new Justice League America and Justice League Europe creative teams are going to be. They make a big announcement like, you know, we can finally say, I mean, I guess it was a secret at this point. I don't know. I knew about it for a long time. I remember. Anyway, they announced Dan Jurgens is going to be writing Justice League America. They announced that the current scripter is going to be writing Justice League Europe. They talk about the artists. And I mean, it was probably an exciting time. I remember having a lenticular button. One for Europe, one for America. Those two buttons, as we were going into Justice League Spectacular and all the stuff that was spinning out of it. So it was kind of an exciting time. your mileage can vary on how you feel that those arrows turned out. But either way, we don't have to worry about it because it's not part of the tenet of the show. Or the remit of the show, I should say. So I got to ask you, Mark, and I ask all my guests. It is time to discuss the breakdowns of this. Because, you know, breakdowns has a very divisive reputation. Some folks love it. Some folks don't. After covering this as long as I have, I'm not really sure where the majority falls anymore. I used to think the majority didn't like it. Now I don't know. Either way, I ask you, this issue as a microcosm by itself, does this issue deserve the bad reputation, or is it better than most people might remember?
Well, taking this issue just on its own, there's no question. It's a dark story. We're gearing up for a climactic battle. The odds seem pretty much hopeless. I think that's what you want out of an issue like this, and I thought it set it up just fine, so I really have nothing to complain about here.
I agree. This even though this isn't the penultimate issue of Breakdowns, it's the penultimate issue of the Battle with Dreamslayer. And yeah, it's setting it up. You get the big villain reveal, you get his monologue, and it's telling you, this is why I'm so dangerous. So it's like Empire Strikes Back, right? The bad guy, the heroes are losing. How are they going to come out of this? And then the ending is obviously the good guys are going to win, or DC would have ended in 1991. But anyway.
Well, I mean, we've talked before, you know, people may have gotten used to the humor of this title, and this isn't that. So if they're bothered by the change, okay, I can understand that. But this totally seems like the issue for things to be more serious.
Yeah. And that's what Breakdowns was supposed to be. It was supposed to be things ramping up, you know, greatest hits, but the league falls apart and can it rebuild itself? And this is the big one. So leading up to it, right? So it's part of, yeah, I agree. I would say it definitely is a win. It as you said, dark. There's not a lot of humor in it, which, by the way, is going to make our next job pretty darn hard. But yeah, I think it's a win. All right. So, Mark, the big thing left is we have to nominate the
Wahaha Award.
This is where we pick the funniest moment of the issue. Both myself and Mark will pick one moment, and only one can be awarded the coveted Bwahaha Award. So, Mark, I got to ask you as the guest, and again, not a lot of laughs in this one, what do you nominate for the Bwahaha Award?
Well, I chose a scene on page 13, where Blue Beetle, who somehow seems to have completely forgotten the conversation they were just having about how serious this situation is, he's asking about some, he calls her, gorgeous babe named Ahula Lula Luau, and gets interrupted and starts talking, but I never laid a hand on Ahula Lula Luau. And Metamorpho criticizes him, cuts the jokes. And Blue Beetle's response, this is the moment I'm keying in on. I can't cut them. They're in my contract. I get paid by the chuckle. No wonder you're broke.
Exactly. Yeah, Metamorpho's response is what makes that work. It's a great moment. And it probably is the funniest moment inside the issue. It is not what I picked.
Okay.
Because I said inside the issue, I'm actually going to nominate the cover.
Have we ever done this before?
We have. And I'm not claiming credit for this. It was actually one of my guests one time nominated the cover for something. And I'm like, duh, you're right. And so whoever it was many, many moons ago, I've stolen the idea from them occasionally when it's appropriate. And I feel like it's appropriate in this one. I feel like the biggest laugh is the cover on this issue. So we got to decide, is it Beetle getting paid by the chuckle and being broke? Or is it this brilliant cover, which is a little questionable nowadays? What do you think, buddy?
Well, you know, I absolutely do agree the cover is funny. And knowing the reference, and at least for me, to know the reference is a Laurel and Hardy gag does bump it up a notch. But I can't say I really laughed out loud, did a wah-ha-ha upon reading that, where I did laugh out loud when Blue Beetle made a comment about getting paid by the chuckle and Metamorpho just shuts him down.
So what I just heard is you said that Kevin Maguire and Terry Austin aren't good enough. Huh. Interesting.
No.
Didn't think I'd hear that on the show. Oh, no. That's what I heard. Didn't think I'd hear that on the show. Tell you what, I'm not going to back down, and you shouldn't back down. Are we okay if we call it a draw?
Well, it is Blue Beetle in both cases, so he would still get the award, right?
Yes, there we go. We'll give it to Ted. There we go. So congratulations to Blue Beetle and the rest of the gang. You win it for the cover of this issue and the guffaws about your chuckles in the contract. So congratulations. Please wear your award with pride. It is tangible as the laughter we give you.
And of course, Martian Manhunter gets his share of the award, too. And he gets so few.
That's true. He does. He's not the funny guy. And here, you're right. He's the delivering the line on the cover. So, yeah, absolutely. Now, Mark, I got to ask a favor. Do you mind hanging out here for a bit, keeping an eye on things? Because if any of the other guys from the Firewater Podcast Network show up wearing a loincloth or a coconut brassiere, would you please just take care of that?
Well, can I at least borrow Beefeater's trademark infringing cosmic rod so that I can keep my distance while pushing them away?
Absolutely. And keep a good grip on that rod, Mark. So, and don't worry, buddy. We will bring you back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, I'm going to be back with our second guest today to look at the 35th issue of Justice League Europe.
It was the early 1990s, the Dark Ages. The Transformers toy line was over. Finished. Without toys in the shelves to advertise, the comic book series created to sell them was likewise canceled after an 80-issue run. Then, the impossible happened.
I didn't believe you. I thought you were lying to me.
Transformers were back in toy stores, and, perhaps even more importantly, Transformers were back on the comic book shelves as well. But this run of Transformers comic proved to be somewhat different than what we'd seen before.
I can implode neutrons!
All of a sudden, the battle between the Autobots and Decepticons threatened to have real consequences.
That was a low-yield neutron implosion!
That was also the precise location of our transport! And Brawn!
Exploding off of the comic book pages with darker, grittier storylines and vibrant, some might even say, neon colors.
The very first thing I noticed was a very 90s art style.
Truly, this was not your father's Autobot. Not Your Father's Autobot is a 13-episode, limited-run podcast beginning in early 2021. Join me, Mark Baker Wright, also known as GB Blackrock, and my brother, Nick Wright, as we go through the entire Marvel US run of Transformers Generation 2, issue by issue, as we look at the series that brought Transformers back from oblivion. After this series, Transformers will never be the same. Look for Not Your Father's Autobot on Podbeam via blackrockstoybox.blogspot.com or wherever podcasts may be found.
Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Spanning from the first issue of Who's Who in 1985 all the way through the Loose Leaf edition.
Including all the updates, the spin-offs, custom Who's Who pages for forgotten characters, and tons of in-depth character spotlights.
Entries span from the golden age of DC
and into the extreme 1990s.
Covering characters such as Superman by Kurt Swan and John Byrne.
The Justice League by Kevin Maguire.
Batman by Dick Giordano.
The New Titans by Tom Grummett.
Wonder Woman by George Perez.
The Legion of Superheroes by Keith Giffen.
The Flash by Carmine Infantino.
Lobo by Simon Bisley.
The All-Star Squadron by Jerry Ordway.
Firestorm by Al Milgram.
Aquaman by Chuck Patton.
So many entries talking about Ian Carcool.
The Forever People again, and again, and again.
And hundreds of other characters found in Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Available wherever you find podcasts and at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Nuclear Man, Batman, Hawkman,
2D Man, and Hour Man. Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of a DC Who's Who.
And now, our coverage of Justice League Europe number 35, Breakdowns, Part 14. And this is the final issue of Justice League Europe we'll cover on this podcast. So enjoy their theme song while you can, folks.
We'll be right back.
We're back from break, and I'm here with our second co-host for this episode. This man is a diehard fan of the JLI and a frequent commenter on the show. He fact-checks all of our chatter and speculation to the point where we have dubbed him our resident historian. I first stumbled across this schlub in the comments section of this very podcast, and I'm now proud to call him a friend. Folks, please help me welcome back to the show Mr. Tim Price. Welcome to the Secret Sanctuary, Tim. Thanks for being on the show again, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Shag. Thank you so much for having me back, even though every time I come in, it seems like that there's more programming and debugging to be done on these old systems. I don't know what the heck Elrond did to them this time, but I'm glad here to help out, and I'm especially glad to be on this episode covering this issue. Like you said, this is a big one. This is the conclusion of the Justice League Europe part of the era, and you know, I'm thrilled to be helping close this chapter.
At least for us. I mean, the book continues, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And the next issue of Justice League Europe technically was like something like aftermath of breakdowns or whatever, but you wisely warned me in advance that I should check that out before I decided to cover it, because it's really not part of the Giffen DeMatteis era at all. It's the creative team for the next run of books. It is tearing it down a little bit more to get ready for the next era of Justice League, and really has nothing to do with what we covered. So, yeah, this will be the last issue of Justice League Europe. This is the penultimate issue, and it really is the final battle. The next issue is the Swan Song instead. So this is the big buildup. This is the final battle, essentially, of breakdowns.
Indeed. And that was the thing. When we talked about it, it's like those were exactly the points that I made. And I can't believe that you remembered them all. You must have kept notes or something. I don't know how else you would have remembered that.
No, I think Mark beforehand told me all that stuff to say.
Oh, okay.
He was kind of on the ball. I kind of set the bar for you. Let's see how you behave.
Well, that does sound like Mark. So I'm very pleased to hear that. And I am not adding him to my list of people over here. It's like,
right. Exactly.
Revenge Mark. Okay. Yes. So moving on.
Excellent. Well, I'm excited to just be pushing through breakdowns, getting to the end here. I'm kind of excited to, the changes that we're going to see through the podcast. I mean, remember, folks, the podcast is still going to keep going through August of next year. We got a lot more stuff to talk about, but we are winding down the original Giffen DeMatteis run. So now at this point in the show, normally we would chat with a guest about their history with the JLI, but you can go all the way back to the February 2019 episode where we talked about Mr. Miracle on that episode. You told us your JLI origin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A million years ago.
2019.
Yeah. First podcast you ever recorded, wasn't it?
Oh, that was the before times, wasn't it? Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's hard to cast my mind back that far into the distant past. It was close to my first podcast.
I know.
I believe I was on a couple others. But, you know, in terms of Shag history, yes, it's definitely my first podcast. Yes, absolutely.
Well, since then, you've gone on to be a big podcasting mucky muck yourself. You stopped being the pod crasher, and then you started being the pod producer over there on the Right On Network. You've got your own Outsiders podcast, which is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I do have a lot of fun doing that show. I still can't believe that AJ agreed to do it with me. The poor guy. He puts up with a lot. But it's been a lot of fun doing that show. I really love that series. And it's been great seeing his reactions to the series because he hadn't read it before. It was new to him. So I really liked our dynamic of that. And it's been great fun. And also just being with him regularly on our Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast. So much fun to discuss that character. So yeah, I still am a pod crasher because the other definitions of crash are, you know, barging in where you're not wanted. I excel at that. And making things fail spectacularly. So I think I still do that part.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. I'm right with you there.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into this thing, man, because I think we got a lot to talk about. So this is Justice League Europe number 35, published by DC Comics, cover date of February 1992, on the shelves January 7th, 1992. The first comic of 92 from of the Justice League. That's amazing. Cover price, nice. $1, four shiny quarters. And the cover, one more time, is by Derek Robertson. And this time he's inked by Romeo Tangal. What do you think of the cover, buddy? What do you tell us about it?
Well, let's see. At the top of this cover, of course, we have the Justice League Europe logo. And we do have in the credits for the book list on the cover, it says art by Robertson and Beatty, which is a little mistake. But that's okay. That's okay. These things happen in breakdowns.
Right.
of all the nitpicks, that is like the smallest one I could have for breakdowns. So anyway, but this cover, we have at the top images of the original extremists and their large images just hovering in the background. Giant size, you might say.
Oh, gosh.
Dr. Diehard, Tracer, Gorgon, and Lord Havoc. Now, why am I saying original extremists? Well, because down at the bottom, these characters are looking at the new extremists who are bursting through the paper of the cover. An all new, all different extremists, as it were. And are they extremists? Why, no. It's our Justice League. And they're all wearing bones and shells and some circular doilies with a cross symbol that's not quite right. It's at an angle. It's kind of weird. But in the center, we have the colossal figure of John Jones flying out. No, to the right of him. And above is the green sun of fire. We have Blue Jay thundering like a bird. Beetle is acting like a bug crawling at night. Power Girl is storming forward. And on the left, we have Metamorpho doing what he does best, which I guess is wearing lots of furs. I think I've seen this cover somewhere else. It's just uncanny. I can't place it. So, but what do you think of this cover?
Well, yes, all the joshing around, definitely an homage to Giant Size X-Men number 1 from 1975, of course, which is where the X-Men premiered Wolverine, Storm, Nightcrawler, and Colossus, all those folks. It's interesting, though, because like they went to a lot of trouble to homage it in many ways, but then in other ways they didn't. Like I kind of expected them to put the characters in similar poses, you know, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, you still get six heroes bursting out in this case, but they're not I mean, Fire's kind of where Storm is, and Martian Manhunter's kind of where Colossus is, but... I mean, does that make Power Girl Wolverine, maybe? I'm not really sure. It's not a one-for-one kind of thing. But it's Derek Robertson, so that's great. I'm not super excited about Romeo Tangal inking over Derek Robertson. Like, I think Romeo Tangal is a very good inker, but I think John Beatty was the inker for Derek Robertson at this point in his career. And I miss Beatty on here. I really think he did a great job. I think they're very suited for each other. So it's not like it's bad. It's just Beatty has a magic with really thick black inks. He just really knows how to use a black edge. And it's a little missing here. Everything here is very fine line, which is fine. I mean, that's the 90s, but it's, I don't know. That's one thing I wish if I could change, I would.
Right. And I don't blame you. When we get into the issue proper, I think that's even more pronounced, that there's some definite pages where this would have felt differently with a different inker. And with Tangal, it doesn't come across as dynamic, or somehow it just doesn't seem as expressive. It feels more muted. It's strange that the change in that style really makes the expressiveness feel, you know, less pronounced. I just don't know why it happens that way. But something about it just doesn't come through as strongly as it did with Beatty doing the inking. So I agree. On the cover, it's also, you can see it to a lesser degree. But, you know, when you look at the faces of Power Girl and Beetle off to the side, even just looking at them, it's like, no, they would have felt a lot stronger. There would have been like a little bit more of a sneer on Power Girl more visibly. This is this feels like just like I'm mildly perturbed, and like but it would have been much more strong there. But there's still part of details that are really great. I mean, there's still parts with that you can see Robertson's design coming through. And yeah, it really is fun.
Martian Manhunter's face is dead on, looks great. You can see that's a Robertson face. You know, Metamorpho's face is with the giant teeth and the anger, looks great. And yeah, so.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it's also just funny to me, the homage factors that, yeah, when I was going through it, the other thing is that, you know, Fire does resemble Sunfire, who was a character in Giant Size X-Men number 1, but he wasn't on the cover.
That's fair.
But this, again, that's a really, the amount of parallels between the X-Men and these extremists that they're pulling through here are so interesting and almost obvious when you think about it. It's like we'd had the whole thing about the parallel to the Avengers and to the specific Marvel villains, but now they really like almost found a way to, maybe I'm just overreading too much into it because I'm analyzing it too much for this show, but there's so many parallels to the X-Men right here too that just drives me crazy. Like we have Lord Havoc.
Interesting. Okay.
Dr. Diehard, Magneto analog. Yep. Tracer, Sabretooth dialogue.
Sabretooth didn't even exist when Giant Size X-Men number 1 came out, to be fair.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But it still was like, you know, the character designs, the costume designs that our leaguers are wearing is the 90s X-Men motif. So,
oh my gosh, I did not get that. Like, I even read your notes and I didn't pick up on what you were saying. You're right. So Martian Manhunter is got kind of the same belt strap that Cyclops wore, and that shell thing with the straps is in the form of an X. Oh my gosh, Tim, I did not pick up on any of that.
And well, and you look at Metamorphos, like, you got the X in the center and the, all the fur on the sides, like, what? Yeah, it's kind of like Wolverine's, but not a whole lot. Now, the hilarious thing is that we have Power Girl, and yes, she's wearing the bikini, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a bikini, but it's really like two clamshells that are just plastered on front of her chest. But if you move those up to the shoulders, they become the shoulder X's that Storm wears on her costume.
Okay. All right.
You know, it's that same design, but just a different placement.
But if you move them up to the shoulders, it becomes an X-rated comic too, by the way. But
exactly. So we're not going to do that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that in terms of design and motif, you can see the parallel. And Beatles is funny because he's wearing the two of them on his head.
Mm-hmm.
The closest thing I could think of that reminds me of is from the Peter David, Larry Stroman X-Factor, and that Madrox Multiple Man would wear an X that was on the center of his forehead. So it would be one that was in the middle. But, you know, Ted's are like to this, both to the sides, making a kind of cap.
Okay.
So it's similar. It's a similar motif, but that's like where almost where he's borrowing that from more than X-Men in particular. But that's exactly what's going on here, is that they're doing the 90s X-Family style costumes with this group here and just, you know, making them with these kind of culturally insensitive approach coming from a tropical island.
Yeah. You know? So you know? Mark and I already talked about some of this. Well, you were in the green room. You probably weren't bothering to listen because, I mean, you're that kind of guest. But
I was busy with other things. I'm a big director now of plays. So, you know, I don't have time for that stuff.
That's very true.
Busy man. Busy man.
We talked about the whole, like, the loincloth, and I was calling them coconut brazier, coconut shell brassieres or whatever. But they don't do a lot for me. Like, you know, I get Power Girl's supposed to be hot because she's barely dressed. It doesn't hit well with me. But, it, you know, it's a joke, though, and that's okay. Not every joke lands with every person. And I said all this already, so you guys at home are hearing it for a second time. But it's okay that the joke doesn't work for me because I'm sure it does with other people. But now that you've enlightened me that there's an X-Men motif going on here, that actually adds a lot to it, which I can't believe I didn't notice that. I mean, obviously, I noticed the giant-sized X-Men number one homage, you know, the name Extremis, the all-new. That's all right there. But I did not pick up on that part. So, wow. Okay. And by the way, folks, if you want to follow along while we're talking about this issue of Justice League Europe, we've got some good news that Tim just enlightened me on just before we started recording. Tim, you want to tell the folks at home what you discovered?
Yes, I discovered that, like, just less than a week ago, perhaps, that the DCU Infinite app does have this issue digitally. So if you have a subscription on DCU Infinite, you can get this issue, and not just this issue, but all the issues of Justice League Europe from this era. And I think it goes straight from issue 1 to 50 even. So it goes all the way past this too, to issue number 50. They're all available on DCU Infinite right now. I think since you saw them disappear at one time, we can't say if they'll be there forever, but they're there as the time of this recording.
I think, you know, without saying too much, I'll just say I think they're probably there for good now. I mean, the situation is DC had these issues available digitally before. In fact, I bought them on Comixology, but then they got pulled when the scripter of this issue went to prison, or at least got arrested. Then they pulled them all. Well, he's out of jail now, and they've got the omnibus, the third omnibus, about to come out. So I guess DC very quietly, I mean, there was no fanfare, there was no announcement. They just kind of, like, I didn't even notice they appeared, and Tim did. So they have added them all back. So all the ones that have been missing all these years are now there. So you feel free to go out there and check them out on DC Infinite. And again, we'll post a few images on our website, but now you can get it much, much easier, everybody. That's exciting news. So
it's super exciting. Also, do wonder, and we about the timing of Keith Diven passing away, if that was a reason for them to bring it back at this time, all the more for it, because anything to honor Mr. Giffen, I'm in favor of.
That's nice. Yeah. I'd like to think it had something to do with it. I imagine it's probably more the omnibus, but
yes, I bet you're right.
But I like your idea better. So, all right, with all that, let's get inside Justice League Europe number 35. Plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen, script by Gerard Jones, penciler Derek Robertson, inker Romeo Tangal, letterer Willie Schubert, colorist Gene D'Angelo, assistant editor Kevin Dooley, and editor Andy Helfer. This is Breakdowns Part 14, The Ceremony of Innocence, which is another reference to William Butler Yeats once again. So, Tim, you want to start us off?
You betcha. So, For issue number 35, the Silver Sorceress lies dying on a Kui beach from an arrow wound, frantically thinking of some way to take Dream Slayer down before she dies. Back at the Justice Cave, the Dreams Lorder-controlled Leaguers face their uncontrolled colleagues, and after the usual join us or die, it's time to fight. None of the Free Leaguers want to, well, except Guy, of course. The Dreams Leaguers have their edge in power, but not their full skills, so it's a close call. Back on Kui, Dreams Lorder monologues to the chief, no, not the Doom Patrol's chief, the island's chief, that he's getting more powerful and easily killed the villagers that resisted him. And with his puppet heroes, he'll rule the world. Meanwhile, Silver Sorceress uses her signal device and some blood, ew, to cast a desperate spell, but does it work? At the cave, the Dreams Leaguers taunt the Free Leaguers to kill them, which backfires, and the heroes quickly start knocking out their friends. Dreams Lorder realizes his mistake and plans to kill everyone on Kui to supercharge his powers when suddenly he's confronted by the extremists?
Well, I'll take it from here. And by the way, I really dig your Dreams Lorder shipping name. I had been using Dream Slayer Lord, so I'm going with Dreams Lorder now. So here we go.
Awesome.
So the Silver Sorceress is taking control of the original inanimate extremist robots, meaning Dr. Diehard, Gorgon, and Tracer. She sets them against Dreams Lorder, and they keep him on the defensive long enough for the Sorceress's robots to capture Dreams Lorder, threatening that she's going to hold him forever. So the attack forces Dream Slayer to vacate Max's body, which thankfully releases the brainwashed League members back at the Secret Sanctuary. Dream Slayer tries to occupy Silver Sorcerer's body because he's without a home right now, but it's a trap by her, and she drags him into battle on the psychic plane. Since the Sorcerer's psyche is being used as the battlefield, she has a distinct advantage over Dream Slayer. And even more dangerous for Dream Slayer is that Silver Sorceress is dying, and she has nothing to lose. So the Silver Sorceress uses her magic, snuffing out Dream Slayer's power and essence once and for all. Now, while she holds on until she's victorious, she cannot go on any further, and she dies. Much later, the Justice League members attend a small memorial service in honor of their fallen comrade. Blue Jay, in particular, is beset with extreme grief, and because it's not just the death of his friend, but she's also his last connection to his homeworld. The Silver Sorceress is buried on Kui, and with so many endings recently, the League members are left wondering what the future holds for the team. Elsewhere, Maxwell Lord, now free of Dream Slayer's control, is racked with guilt over the things that he did while he's possessed. Given a clean bill of health, Max seems lost. Even responding when asked if he's Maxwell Lord, he says, "I was, pal, I was." Then that's it. Next issue, Justice League America number 60 is Breakdowns Part 15 of 15. They describe it as, you might say, that means we're wrapping it up, and we are in more ways than one, and boy, are you going to be surprised. So there we go. That was the final battle, and the penultimate issue of Breakdowns. What'd you think, buddy?
Whew. Man, it was emotional. Emil, yeah. We've talked about this before, that this series brought a lot of funny, but that meant that when the big dramatic things happen, they hurt so much worse. And this is one last dying battle for the Silver Sorceress, a character we've had in the book since issue number 2 of Justice League.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, sort of, kind of, in a way.
You know, it's like, has she been a continuous presence? No. But she was right there in issue number 2 as Wealth Blue Jay. So when we talk about this series pulling in Marvel motifs, they did it all the way from the very beginning.
Yeah.
They just didn't keep it. They weren't doing it all the time, but it was there.
I hadn't thought about the fact of how long she'd been around. That's interesting. You know, sadly, though, I mean, I got to argue that, you know, she was never developed, though. I mean, she never did anything.
Mm-mm.
Are you disagreeing or are you agreeing?
I agree that they did not do really anything with her. That's the thing, is that we get this whole issue devoted to her, and it hurts a lot because I think that they depict the story very well. Now, do we feel anything particularly for this character specifically, or could it have been any character dying and would have been the same story? Yeah, it would have been the same story with regards to what the character was. So it doesn't really hit any extra that way, but they still do an excellent job of it. So I think that's what makes it ring for me. You know, what did you think about? What did you think about this issue overall?
Well, no, that's absolutely fair. Addressing your point there, you know, I'm actually glad she got to go out saving the world. That's a heroic death. That's fantastic, mm-hmm. and it was a lot of characterization. Mm-hmm. It is sad they never really used her before this, though. And sort of, if you look at her and sort of her partner, Blue Jay, it's kind of even sadder that he's out too, and he never even got a big moment. You know, like so, at least right. she got yeah. one, which is nice. And if you think about the whole death aspect of it, you know, before her dying, the only deaths that we had of Justice Leaguers in the book were Vibe and Steel. That's it. Mm-hmm. She's the first Justice League International member to die. I mean, sure, there was the fake Mr. Miracle death, but that was fake. We all know that. So yeah, Vibe and Steel were the only ones to die before this. Now, outside of Justice League, yes, we've lost Barry Allen. We've lost Kent Nelson. They think they've lost Captain Atom, but haven't really. So that's kind of a big deal for someone to die. It's just, you know, as someone who's maybe not even read Justice League Europe, they might be going, I don't even know who this was, you know? So
right. Yeah. Overall, which
though,
is fair.
Overall, I enjoyed the issue, though. I thought that the stakes were high. You know, Dream Slayer was mm-hmm. going to rule the world, and the Justice League got to fight the probably the toughest members. I mean, you're up against Power Girl and Metamorpho and Fire and Martian Manhunter. Those are some pretty heavy guns there. And mm-hmm. I don't know that they would have won. Thankfully, Silver Sources really is the one that won that battle for them. But I felt like I enjoyed this issue quite a bit.
Awesome. That's great. Well, you know, and this story, I looked it up, came out 5 months after X-Men number one, which went on sale August 13th, 1991. So in order for them to do this riff on that version of the X-Men costumes, they had to hustle, unless they had like early designs that they managed to get a hold of from friends or something. You know.
Well, I mean, Marvel had been promoting it for months, you know, really. Yeah. And if they really wanted to be cool, they could have made this a gatefold cover. You know, I'm just saying.
That, that is completely fair. Not that I have that gatefold cover myself. No, not me. Mm-mm. No.
I've got the gatefold and all five of the, or with all five of the stupid covers I've got. Oh, my God.
Oh, wow. And we complain about the alternate covers nowadays.
I was just stupid. I didn't know any better.
But yeah, like I said, that was just another thing where how they tied this all together with and make this parallels to the X-Men. They really just having fun with that. I think that was the other side that, in spite of the drama here, there's a little bit of the tongue-in-cheek wink at the X-Men as well. So
I would agree
with that.
Yeah. And once you point out the costumes, it's like, oh, duh, even more so. Right. Now, speaking mm-hmm. of costumes, by the way, Fire and Rocket Red kind of got lucky in that they didn't have any alterations to their costumes simply by the very nature of how they're dressed. So I don't know I don't think there's an X-Men parallel with them. But still, it's if I was them, I'd be happy I wasn't wearing a coconut brassiere. But anyway,
I don't know. Dimitri would probably look pretty awesome in one. So, you know, just saying.
Hokey smokes.
Hokey smokes.
So let's get into this here. So yeah, Silver Sorceress on the first page, on the beach, dying. I mean, she's even talking about how bizarre that she's dying on a tropical island from a stomach wound, which is just not how she would have expected to go. And it does say something here. You know, they've been incredibly inconsistent about her costume and the fact that her stomach has a cutout. Like her tummy is exposed mm-hmm. in her costume, which is kind of a weird costume design. But either way, and she got in the stomach. So I'd say that's an argument for armor or at least full clothes.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong on that point at all. But also, like, on those opening pages, like, this is where, in spite of the inking not being as great as before, mm-hmm. I still like the artwork on these pages a lot. It's appropriately unsettling, the fact that she really does look like she's in huge distress here.
Yeah.
You know, the way her fingers claw at the sand, and we see the marks from that, the expression she has, and gritting her teeth, looking at her own red fingers, and the thoughts she's having to herself about what's going on. It's like, yeah, it's a hard to read scene, but it's, you know, it's gets to you. It really does get to you. At least for me, it did.
Oh yeah. And also you're seeing, even though you've got Romeo inking it, you can see clearly Derek's panel design, because Giffen mm-hmm. doesn't do panel design like this. You know, he does breakdowns right. at mm-hmm. very simplistic box type shapes. And so this is clearly Derek, especially like on page two, Derek doing those angle cuts. I mean, and the panels mm-hmm. that overlap each other and stuff like that's clearly Robertson doing that. We've seen it in the past couple issues, and it's a creative tool for, especially for someone so young in the industry. I like it.
Yeah. I got to get on the bandwagon about praising Derek Robertson for this. I've said it in the comments plenty as well, but and in this issue as well, he's just knocking it out of the park. He's just killing it in this series from the very first issue. I still don't know why he didn't get Justice League America instead of Wozniak. I'm sorry. I just don't get it.
All I can think is just that Robertson was too new and they didn't trust him and didn't know what they had for him. And I don't know that they knew what they had with Wozniak at that point either. So no,
that's both fair. Very fair points. Yeah. But boy, it just came apparent after like the very first month. That's like one of these things is not like the other.
Yeah.
I just really love it. And I mean, like the details on Sorceress sweating on each of these pages, like, oh, that's just rough. Amazing stuff.
You get the sense she's dying. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then on page three, it's like, then the possessed heroes are facing off against our free leaguers or freegers, as we might. No, I don't know that part. Fleegers. There we go. The fleegers. And, okay, why are they standing on a checkerboard? They're standing on a checkerboard. Okay, sure. In the cave. I don't know what that's. It's funny because it almost does look like this might be one of those oversized games of chess between the two teams.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of the, didn't they have a checkerboard pattern at the embassy as well, if I remember right? The flooring had a very specific pattern on the floor at the New York embassy that was always immediately recognizable. And I feel like maybe this is the same pattern. I should know this. I'd run a stupid show about this.
I don't think that's necessarily the case, but that's okay. I'm either way. I was too distracted by the doilies in the embassies anyway.
So. Brett will be very proud of you.
Yes. You're welcome, Brett.
On that page, there's a couple things that are interesting to look at. One is the I like that Sue is actually running away from the battle.
Yes, so Sue, that's a great touch.
Because that makes sense. She's like, oh, it's about to go down. All right, I'm out of here. So she runs away, which I like that. And then the way the possessed leaguers, they just look so robotic. You know, there's no body language. They're just standing there very still. They're talking through Maxwell Lord's voice and stuff like that. So, well, I in a previous episode, I kind of bemoaned the fact that we didn't get Starro in Breakdowns because I felt like, you know, if we're doing all the greatest hits, we should have had Starro. But this really, really has, I mean, they even call it out in the issue, really has echoes of the storyline with Starro where they're fighting mind-controlled teammates and stuff like that. I feel it's very much of a piece of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you still get the sense of it. So that works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and if we're going to go for Marvel parallels, is there any better Marvel parallel than Heroes Fighting Heroes? So there we go.
They do that a couple times, don't they?
They do. And then we have Mind Control. And it's like, is that another homage to the X-Men? Because they have a leader who has like mental powers. Oh, he would never use them and abuse them on his own students. Never. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't want to go down that path. I like Professor X, and whenever he's displayed as a complete jerk for messing with people's minds, it always bothers me.
I have to agree. I do like Professor X to be treated well. I don't think that that's always the case. Well, and then the fight kicks into play, and, you know, yeah, this is where the inking really does kind of show its weakness. It's like, it's just not as... Batman doesn't look on model. General Glory doesn't look that great. And he usually looks pretty great. And Ted doesn't look great. It's like, it's not wowing me, but, you know... You still some pieces there.
Like, if you jump forward to page 11, that one's the one that jumped out at me. When the extremist robots show up, it's a full-page splash of the extremist robots. And you can see the layout of the page is fine, and the characters penciled are fine, but it's a rough-looking page. And I gotta think that's the inking. Like,
yes.
That does not look like a Derek Robertson. No, I would never guess in a million years that's a Derek Robertson page. And yet, obviously, it is, because Derek drew it, penciled it, so that's down to the inking for me. And it's... That's the kind of thing when you look at something like that and you just go, okay, either someone was rushed or just he's not the right inker. Because there's other pages that look amazing, but that one just really jumped out at me. Is oof, not the splash page I expected.
Yeah, I do agree on that point. Although it also, in a way, oddly for me, it kind of kept the tone proper of something's wrong with the robots. Something's wrong with them. They don't look like themselves. They're not as... confident, and also because like some of them are missing parts, so it almost added to the je ne sais quoi. I just wanted to fix that word in there.
Wow.
of the moment. But it's like, that doesn't make it any... I think it would look better with a different inker, though. I think we still could get that across, but just but it does look awkward.
Yeah,
you know? It's oddly muted,
which is weird, because then if you just go forward two more pages, like page 13 is amazing. There's a Batman on that page and a Catherine Colbert, which are stunning.
Oh, yeah. That bottom panel on 13 that you're talking about. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's in my notes there. It's like, Batman there looks awesome.
Yeah.
But then we look at Batman on page 8 when he's facing off and John has just turned invisible. And you go, what have you done to Batman?
Yeah, something's off there, definitely. Yeah. The perspective, the body. But, and it's not just Batman, though, on page 13, though. Like, Catherine looks amazing, too. Catherine always looks amazing. But well, she looks especially amazing there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and even John at the top with him screaming of the mind control being stopped.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really great expression there.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like on... It's almost like Tangal did better with the close-ups than he does with the full body shots and the distance shots.
Mm, yeah, that could be. That could
almost
be.
Almost like that. He's really good, but the close-ups seem really nice. I think that's where he's... Maybe he's rushing when he has more time for the close-ups. He's doing more details, but on the faraway stuff, his quick work to make those inked just doesn't come through as well. I don't know.
And it almost seems like certain pages got more attention as well. So
right, that's perfectly fair. Yeah.
Like if you're talking about some of the full page splashes look good. So like page 20, which is the full page splash of the Justice League leaving the island, and you get the silhouette, the ghostly image of Silver Sorcerer in the back. That's a heck of a great page. It looks fantastic. It is. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. The sorcerer's her hair alone. Yeah. It's just flowing and looking forlorn and it's a beautiful image.
The only thing that detracts from that is Derek did sign the page, and it just tells me like, oh, that's the beginning of the 90s. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to fault him for it. I mean, that was the era. But right. I'm glad you mentioned her hair, because both Bart Sears in the part we just covered and this one, both of them took a lot of time to really focus on Silver Sorceress's hair. And it's a really powerful feature, that stark white hair. It's beautiful. It looks really nice.
Right. And that's what's so ironic, and again, shows how the character wasn't treated well all this long, is that her costume design has that bunny rabbit ear helmet normally covering up this hair.
Uh-huh.
So it's just funny that again, she should be a more interesting character to look at. And instead we've got this brown helmet on her head. So yeah, just a funny thing.
Since we're talking about art, one more big art thing to mention. So, all right. Do me a favor. Go to page 18.
Okay.
This is where everyone's at the ceremony, the memorial. Blue Jay's at her grave.
Yes.
And the bottom of the page has all just little headshots of all the characters there. You can see like Tora, her head's down, is kind of shaking, and Fire's crying. And you see that one, right?
Yes.
Who's that on the far right?
They're on the right,
right next to Metamorpho.
Yeah,
on the bottom panel.
Yeah, it's a woman wearing a headband.
I think that's Power Girl.
It does look like the hair design
in her new costume. She's about to debut in 2 issues of Justice League Europe.
I have to say you're right. I did not notice that before. I had not paid attention to that.
And I don't know that I would have noticed if I didn't have the digital copy, but I'm like, okay, wait, it's a headband. She's got Power Girl's hair that she wore later. The headband has a little thing in the middle of it. Oh my gosh, I think that's Power Girl and the costume that she doesn't have yet. But it probably would have been in promotional material at this point, because they were already really heavily promoting the changeover. So yes. That's what I think's going on.
I you have to be right. I mean, I don't know what else it would be. I am looking and trying to think about what other character it could possibly be. The only other thing it could have been would have been if for some reason it was Sue standing over there wearing a headband for reasons.
Nah.
It doesn't make sense.
She's wearing a headband and it's got a circle in the middle, which is exactly what Power Girl's going to wear. A headband with a circle in the middle in that costume she's about to start using. So I think...
If you look real closely, I think the collar that we're seeing in the far corner also works.
Could be.
In that new costume.
Yep. I think that Romeo was probably inking, and her hair does that big swoopy thing in the new costume too. I think Romeo was inking it, and maybe it was a little vague, and so he's like, oh, what's Power Girl look like? And he just pulled up whatever drawing he saw for her costume, which was the new one, and he went with that, which is the blue and white one with the diamond window for the boob and the headband and all that. Yeah, so... I'm not thrilled with it, but it's kind of cool. Like, oh, wow, look at that. I never would have noticed that if I hadn't been for a digital version.
You win the prize for this episode for getting that right there. Fantastic job. I did not spot that.
I feel so happy for noticing her ugliest costume. So there we go. All right.
Well, it's a win? Question mark? Oh, the other things I got is let's go to page 14 where we have the mindscape.
Oh, right.
The mental battle is going to happen. I know that Jared Albrecht is excited that there's a mental battle going on here. but the landscape, we have this big tentacle going through, and there's this mist and other indistinct forms kind of like crisscrossing in the background. And it's looks like it should be a Ditko-esque kind of background, but it doesn't sell it enough. honestly. It's a little bland compared to what I've seen in Doctor Strange and other things for and Ditko-inspired sort of backgrounds. And that's what it feels like it ought to be. It makes me want it to be that, with like how the story is progressing, what's happening here. And I get what they're trying to go for, but it just didn't work out. It just didn't work out as well as I'd like.
So Scarlet Witch versus Dordammu should be a very Ditko-esque escape. I see what you're saying. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, no.
Right,
okay.
Right.
I will say the whole idea here of her plan forcing Dreamslayer to vacate Max's body is pretty solid. I was like, oh, I was actually, once I read the issue and then went back and really studied it all, I'm like, oh, that's actually a really clever plan on her part. And then battling in the mindscape, like, mental battles are always a tricky thing because, like, if you really sit and think a lot about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, it's like, what? How does that work? And how does she, you know, destroy him just because she does? Willpower? I don't know. But the logic of it doesn't quite work, but it just, like, it feels right. Like, the gut instinct, this is the way she should be Dreamslayer. And, yeah, she should be the one to do it. So, like, there's an intuitiveness that feels good about it. And I'm going to do that rather than focus too much on the logic, I think.
Mm-hmm. That is fair because it is how it works. I mean, this is comics for you. I mean, this is comic logic. It's not really practical, and it shouldn't be. We don't. So I'd have no problem with that. It's like, yeah, she's going to use this. And this is, a mystical battle sort of approach to fight on a different battlefield. And the fact also that Dreamslayer was in a body that wasn't able to physically defend itself against the robots. So him being arrogant thinks that, oh, sure, I can take care of her mentally. So he falls for it. And that's, again, his ego in action. So, yeah, that's it all works for me. I just I dig it. I dig it. I do want the presentation to be a little bit more out there, but that's okay. It worked for me.
No, that totally makes sense. I agree. The Ditko S is missing, but otherwise the battle itself is great. And the fact that, you know, the way she takes him out is it's satisfying. You know, there's like a cathartic feeling when he's gone. It's like, oh, whew. And then they just jump right to her memorial. I mean, they don't waste any time.
Now, also, while we're talking about, you know, Scarlet Witch and Dormammu, is that the other kind of parallel that a Silver Sorceress reminds me of is Clea, who has white hair.
Oh, okay.
And Clea is the niece of Dormammu.
Oh, jeez.
And I don't think this was intentional, but in a way, and this is kind of my headcanon now is gone too, is that this is what would have happened if Clea had joined the Avengers. That she could have become, that she might have been the magical woman on the team as opposed to Scarlet Witch. And because she actually is always presented more as a this character, Silver Sorceress, is presented more as a magic user and not a mutant or someone who affects probabilities.
Right.
She's a magic user. So, you know, she almost could be close to being Clea. And now we have a final battle where Clea gets to finally kill Dormammu.
That would be really nice thematically to do that. And she does come across more as a Clea than a Scarlet Witch. So, no, I mean, obviously the name is where your connectivity is. But, yeah, I totally see what you're saying. And, yeah, I think it works. Yeah, good call.
Yeah.
We can say that in our headcanon. How's that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's where I'm going. Because everything's headcanon, really, at its heart.
I mean, really. I mean, with the number of times DC's been rebooted, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and yeah, and the way that she finally takes him out with putting her finger through his energy head and crushing what's left in there with a zark on that page.
Right.
Oh, yeah. When you said cathartic, yeah, that's like fist bumping cathartic. And then she's gone. It's like, oh,
right.
God.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. It really is. You feel it. And then we get to go into the sadness. So I do like that they mention a couple times in this issue about the island of Kahui being alive. And how burying her there is good because the island's alive. And earlier, Max was going to tap into the living entity of Kui and try and use the energy of the living island. But I'm glad that comes into play and it gets recognized again because it's not something that's like, I forgot about it until they mention it. I'm like, oh yeah, the island moves on its own. So I'm glad that they brought that up and mentioned it because, you know, it's another one of the characters in the story, really.
Absolutely, yeah. And is also one of those things where it's like, oh no, don't kill Kui. I was legitimately worried for Kui. In as close as you know, knowing that the heroes are still going to win. It's like, of course not. But it's like, what's Kui going to do to defend themselves? It's like, oh, no. So, yeah, that was good that they kept that story beat going. And, yeah, on those pages of, like, especially page 19, Catherine looking gorgeous and crying her eyes out and just looking, but and still, you know, dressed classy as she always is. And Blue Jay looking bereft in those final pages. Like, they're just... again, Robertson's just knocking it out of the park. I mean, I feel all these emotions here.
So one thing about that scene where he's kneeling at her grave, like, everybody grieves differently, right? So I'm not trying to sound too critical, but in the art, he's like directly kneeling on top of the freshly dug earth. Like, that's not really my style. I'm kind of like on the side kind of guy, not on the spot over the body. But that's just me. Everybody grieves differently.
Well, and also, he's from a different Earth, so maybe the social norms are that you're supposed to do it. I don't know.
There we go. Good note, Bryce.
We'll go for that.
Yep. Yeah, you talked about the Kui 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 people and the natives that are there. I mean, that may be all that's left. Because, I mean, Dream Slayer murdered, I don't know if they quantified how many, but he murdered a ton of the natives on Kui Kui Kui. And, I mean, there were bodies just piled up everywhere. So, really, Jean surrendered the Justice League in order to save the Kui 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 people. And Dream Slayer didn't hold up his end of the bargain. He killed him anyway, which is just so disturbing.
Yes. It's a bloodbath. For our Wahaha comic book series, it's a brutal, brutal thing. But then the extremists in general, whenever those have shown up, it's been real. There's been some real consequences and whenever they've shown up.
It's interesting. Going into the coverage of this series, you know, 7.5 years ago, I did not think of Dream Slayer as one of the big bads of the Justice League. I don't know whether I just forgot that he was the penultimate villain of Breakdowns or what. But he wasn't on my radar as one of the extremists, perhaps, from their previous story, but not Dream Slayer. And now I got to say, Dream Slayer is one of the biggest bads. You know, him and Despero and things like that are some of the biggest bads in Queen Bee of the series.
Yeah, absolutely. As the historian, I co-sign that. I joke about the historian thing, but it's like, yeah, that's just, I've loved the series so much. I've reread it from beginning to end so many times. Now that I have subscriptions to Marvel Unlimited and DCU Infinite, and I can read all these new-to-me series, I don't have as much excuse to reread things. But when I didn't have that kind of thing, I was rereading my comic books a lot more often. Mm-hmm. And this was on the regular rotation at least every 2 years.
Oh, wow.
I would reread it every 2 years. And I loved it all the time. So, yeah, I completely co-signed it.
This was my first time in 30 years. I kept to my word and I didn't really read ahead. Now, I have read issue 60, so I have read ahead one issue. But I kept to my word and just read the issues we were covering. So I didn't know where the story was going to go. And this was a wild ride. I want to go back to the fight, if we can, for a minute here. So,
sure.
Because nerds kvetch, right? I do have a little kvetching continuity issue to complain about. So there, the heroes are squaring off against their friends. There is a great moment I love where General Glory tells Rocket Red, he goes, dang it, Red, and I was almost thinking of you as an American. Like, that genuinely made me laugh out loud. I like that bit. But I got to mention Guy Gardner. So, we just covered Justice League America in 59, me and Mark. And that issue leads immediately into this issue. There is no gap. At the end of that issue, Guy Gardner was in plain clothes and he had his arm in a sling. And this issue picks up immediately afterwards, and now he's in his outfit, and he has a cast rather than a sling. And on top of that, he's wearing his ring on the wrong hand. He always wears his ring on the other hand, on his right hand, but here he's got it on his left.
Yes.
Now, to be fair, you can no prize it. He says he switched it for the injury, but just little niggling things like that from a continuity perspective, always, whatever reason, get under my skin.
I understand. And that they've had plenty of these in this series. I mean, we've had times about the costume in one issue, not costume in the next issue, happened back and forth quite a bit. I was getting tired of complaining about the Injustice League being in costume versus not costume from issue to issue myself. That's why I finally stopped complaining about it, because it's like, it happens every time.
Yeah.
Guy being in costume, though, changing into costume as a Green Lantern is part of the ring. The ring does that. So
that's true.
That didn't throw me. But yes, when you talk about him, about the cast part especially, and the ring being on the wrong hand, that's a big detail.
Yeah.
So, and worthy at least of being addressed. Even if you let it go, you still should have addressed it.
Yeah.
And the reader shouldn't be trying to fill in the blank on that.
You know, you mentioned the Injustice League just reminded me, like, I do wish they had gotten a better send-off rather than sneaking out the back door. You know, they did not get a proper send-off in this era, and that makes me sad. And We also didn't see Mr. Miracle in right. a farewell. I feel like we should have got mm-hmm. a Mr. Miracle here at the end as well. But I'm showing a little bit of my hand too much for next issue saying these things. But either way, they're on my mind.
No, that's fine. Well, I already know, so it's fine. I'll keep my mouth shut. But yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because just talking about Mr. Miracle again a little bit is that I really liked hearing you kind of going through this, because I could tell that you hadn't read ahead and you were mm-hmm. wondering about it. The setups were all there. You were right when you were reading those other issues back at, right around issue number 50 and mm-hmm. saying, it looks like they're going to be bringing in Shiloh. The setup was really, when I was reading it there with you as we're going along, it's like, that's right. It does look like Shiloh's going to be coming into the team.
Yep.
I knew he wasn't going to be, though.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what was funny, is that, no, the setup is all there, which makes me go, how much did they really have breakdowns in mind at that time? Because it seemed odd that they changed course on that. But they obviously did, because it's like they're really making it seem like this is going to be a thing. But then nothing.
Well, they inducted him into the league. I mean, they officially, like, yeah. him and General Glory in the same time were both mm-hmm. officially sworn into the league, and Shiloh's never yeah. seen again.
Well, my point of order, if you look at issue 50 again, they don't actually like give Shiloh a signal device or mm-hmm. say he's in the league. He and Scott argue about him being in the league, but they don't actually have the words said, we want Shiloh in the league, and Shiloh saying, I'm in. Screw you, old man. They don't quite say that.
Okay.
So there's wiggle room for saying that he didn't actually join. But, you know, this group being the way they are and have people come in and out, you know, Booster popping in for an issue or two because he's just friends. Yeah, mm-hmm. It works too. So, you know, it's that going for a very formal declaration of him being in, as he was in no posters posing or anything, like there's no Avengers Assemble on the front, Leaguers lambasted on the front lawn or anything to say, I stole that from JLA Avengers, by the way. So,
okay.
They didn't quite come there, but you know, it's still there's, like you said, the groundwork was there and it didn't happen. So it's really interesting to see that, knowing that breakdowns was coming and going, did they change tactics somewhere? Or maybe they knew what was coming up with what was happening in the Mr. Miracle series, they decided to drop him from the league as well.
Yeah. There's a million different reasons to speculate. I mean, we've also heard the story that, you know, supposedly Giffen and DiMatteis wanted to leave around issue 50 and Helfer talked him into staying. So they may have had an idea that they were going to add Shiloh and hand off the book, maybe is what they were thinking or something. You know, so again, it's all speculation. Who really knows?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's interesting discussion, though, certainly.
Yeah. So I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Page 17.
All right.
Silver Sorcerer is saying, I may be colorblind, but I'm not stupid. So being colorblind, is that a silly reveal or brilliant? What do you think?
Can I say both?
Yes, you can.
Everybody complains about the Silver Sorceress having a gold costume, right? Everybody talks about this thing.
Yes.
And, you know, once she takes the headpiece off and she's got the white hair, we're all kind of like, oh, okay, kind of works there. Then why is she wearing the stupid headpiece? It looks like a rabbit, whatever. But I think this is either Keith, the plotter, or the writer trying to solve an issue that has been there since the beginning and explain why she's called Silver Sorceress. So I think it's funny, but it's also brilliant. So I'm on board with both.
Okay, that is perfectly fair. And I have to say the same thing, although I do lean more towards the brilliant side myself. I think it was a clever thing to include, as how many characters do we know that are actually colorblind, and do they even talk about it in comics? No, they
right.
never talk about it mm-hmm. unless it's a plot device, mm-hmm. a plot point that this person couldn't know the answer because they're colorblind. That's the only time it ever comes up.
Right.
So
yeah.
I appreciate them just doing that, because there's a lot of people who are colorblind. I mean, but they also, you don't know unless they tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? So it's like, it's also it's not a problem. They figured out how to make things work and they let me know when it's a problem. Okay. All good. Being her costume color, it's like, yes, that's the number one thing. You are going to drive us nerds insane by not explaining something so obvious that's out of whack. So I found it extremely satisfying for somebody to actually say, here's why she wears such a wonky color costume. Here it is.
I wonder if around the DC office, they had decided that like a long time ago when people started complaining, and they said, yeah, she's colorblind, but, you know, we'll find the right time to use that gag. And then they're like, well, this is it. I mean, this is her last issue, so we better squeeze it in here somewhere.
Right. And for all we knew, her original appearance back in Justice League of America was a coloring mistake, for all we know.
Probably.
They could have mistakenly colored her that way, or there was a disconnect between the colorist's directions and what the writer wrote. And we don't have any idea. But I just really found it satisfying, and I just also thought it was a badass line for her to finish on.
Yeah, it's a great one.
I just love it. I love it. I'm not stupid. I love it. So good. So
yeah, good. Great ending for her.
Mm-hmm. And we have Max back for real. I mean, that's just, what else can we say about that? It's just, he's thoughtful. He's, you know, he knows he's gone through a lot, and he has things to make up for. So it's like, well, I don't know. And when we're reading this the first time, it's like, we didn't know what's going to come next.
I love the character of Max so much, and it hurts me that he's gone now and what they've done with the character. Mark had a great suggestion in the first half of this episode, was that perhaps Dream Slayer enhancing Max's powers is part of the reason Max is so powerful later on when he does all the evil stuff in those stories that never happen. Mm-hmm. But it makes me sad that we get this with Max, right? And then, like, in a month, you know, when the next teams come on here, they quickly sideline Max. You know, they just move him out of the way. And he never really comes back except to be evil. And it just breaks my heart. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it shows that our creative team here really had some magic about what they could do with a character like this.
Mm-hmm.
Between Giffen's quirkiness and DeMatteis's gift for capturing characters.
Mm-hmm.
That really brought something that could bring a real world person into this team and make it work. The powers were not the important part. It was Max, the character, that was the important part. And the follow-on usage of him without the powers, they really just don't know how to write a normal person and make him interesting around these heroes. That's what it felt like. This is not me bashing other creators. They're fantastic creators who come on this book afterwards. But it's this kind of character is not their strength. That's all I'll just say, is that it's not their strength. And these two had magic that they could bring into them and bring life to him and make him just fascinating. I think it's a harder character to write than Amanda Waller. Amanda Waller actually is a really tough character. It was hard to imagine who would write her after Ostrander left the Suicide Squad. But there have been some interesting things with her along the way as well, which also is a tough as nails character. She's almost easier to write. Max had that very much complexity.
Mm-hmm.
He was so complex. I think that's what made him harder to write afterwards.
Well, also the humor is part of it, because there's always a bit of sly humor in him turning his nose up at the situation, and his corporate greed is part of it, but still, you know, pure of heart kind of thing.
Yes.
It's a delicate balance that, no one really found the way to do it again later. And I'm glad you mentioned Waller, because, I mean, those are two great cases where comic books have managed to take two characters in just plain clothes. I mean, that is not very often that you find a superhero comic where you have somebody in plain clothes that you genuinely care about. And it's a special knack. And those are two, I'm sure there's a lot more, but those are the two that come to mind that really, really resonate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, there's no mistaking the fact that with them crossing over in issue 13 of both of the books, that, you know, that's why they're both created around the same time.
Yeah.
They debuted around the same time. And their personalities and I would dare say their best takes were during that era.
Yeah.
There's been some good takes of Waller since then. I don't know if I would like the current take. I haven't really read much of it. But Max, it's a shame. It's a shame because there's a lot of potential. Just had to find the right creative team to work with him.
And I would say we're back in an era of corporate greed enough that you could make this character work again and still lean into the corporate greed humor. But, you know, maybe that's just because I'm embedded too much into my real life. But anyway.
Well, I did have one other thing in that I've been started a spreadsheet of all of the appearances of our heroes throughout this era.
Oh.
And just to see which characters had how many appearances and how many comics. You know, so it's a comic appearance sort of list.
Interesting. So I got to ask, though, so when you're defining an appearance, is this like include group shots where they don't speak, like, and they're just in the background and not colored?
Yes. Okay. It includes any time that they, as a character, are physically in the book.
Okay.
So flashbacks do not count.
Mm.
You know, but even if you're silent in the issue and don't say anything, you know, ice, then that counts.
Okay.
You know, it's like, ugh. So, yeah. And I included, you know, all these issues of the 60 issues of the main series, the 35 issues of Justice League Europe, the annuals, the five quarterlies, and the first Justice League International special. Even though that was a Mr. Miracle kind of spinoff, it's also really, it felt like it still fit into the Justice League series.
Yeah, but, absolutely. You know,
but the second one did not feel as much. The second one was so much a Huntress story that just had guest appearances by the Justice League.
Completely so, agree.
I didn't count that one.
What a cool, fun idea to compile this. This must have been a lot of work, but I love this idea.
It was work, but it was fun. I actually started it last year during my read-through of Justice Society, All-Star Comics, the original All-Star Comics.
Ooh, okay.
I finished the Justice League of America run, and I thought, you know, I want to read something else to kind of keep the year going. So, foolish me, I jumped into the original All-Star Comics that were on DCU Infinite. And also, there I was like, how many times are these characters appearing? So I kind of, because it just was kind of bugging me.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because, like, we had the Flash and Green Lantern show up fairly early, and then they disappeared.
Hmm.
And other characters came in. It's like, well, who's been in here more? And then what, my own headcanon about which characters should be in the Justice Society more than others was kind of thinking about it. It's like, well, let me just go count them up. So I just kind of like did a simple spreadsheet, just, you know, put a mark in each issue that the character is in and, you know, sum that up. So it's interesting. It was interesting to see the numbers that came through.
Wait, are you telling me Mr. Terrific wasn't a major star in the original All-Star Comics as part of the Justice Society? That's crazy.
I'll have to go confirm that in my notes.
He, as far as I remember, I don't think he was even in it once. Or he teamed up with them maybe one time and that was it. And yet he gets rolled into it in the Silver Age and then they kill him. So,
mm-hmm. No, that's not right. Yeah. It's like he was not, that's exactly right. That was a character that was not in very much. And then also like the Flash and Green Lantern were not in there as much as you think because they were in there for like the first two or three issues. And then they were taken out because their own books were popular enough, they didn't need to keep appearing in All-Star Comics.
Exactly. Yep.
Its whole job was to advertise the other comics.
Yep.
I caught on to that pretty quickly. And with that, it's like, well, without them needing to be in here, then we have room for other characters to come in and advertise for their comics. So it was like, but the big mainstay is Flash and Green Lantern, not in as many comics as you would think.
Interesting.
It's pretty funny. Yeah.
So tell me about this spreadsheet. So you've created this amazing spreadsheet, and where are we going with it right now?
Okay, so what I want to do, since this issue features so heavily the Silver Sorceress,
mm-hmm.
and as I mentioned, I warned you, she appeared way back in Justice League number 2. I'm going to give you the names of two characters, and one has more appearances, and one has less appearances than Silver Sorceress, and I want you to guess which one is which.
Mm. So are we talking significantly, or like off by one or two?
It's they're the closest ones.
Okay.
I won't fib.
All right.
They're the ones that are closest to her.
Well, that's fun. That's fun. Okay. This will be great. Okay.
Okay.
So lay it on me.
Okay. So alphabetically, one of the characters, General Glory.
Okay.
The other character, Elrond, because Elrond's a member of the team.
Sure. Sure. Now, are you counting back when he wasn't a member as well?
Yes.
Okay. That's fine. All right. So Elrond, he comes down. Okay. 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 One has more, one has less. So I'm going to say General Glory has more and Elrond has less. I'm probably going to be eating my words in a minute, but I'm just thinking there were a lot of times where Elrond wouldn't get seen since he was an administrative guy. Whereas General Glory, even if he wasn't speaking, he would have been there for a battle or in the background or whatever. So that's my guess.
That was a very good guess. It was not correct, but it was a very good guess.
All right. So Elrond has more appearances than Silver Sorceress and General Glory.
So to give you context, Silver Sorceress, I counted at 30 appearances.
That's insane. That is almost impossible to believe.
But if you think about that, she was in Justice League Europe almost continuously from issue number 14. No, 15.
Okay.
Issue number 15 with the Extremists. And there's a couple issues before that in Justice League Europe, the setup.
Mm-hmm.
She's in that almost continuously. That's 20 issues alone.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's 30. So, General Glory, 24 appearances.
That is surprising, given he was only introduced, if we're on issues, we go to issue 60, and he only first appeared, around 44? 46? Okay, yeah.
46.
Yeah, so that's surprising. Wow.
Yeah. But between the annuals,
yep,
the quarterlies,
yep,
and the occasional appearance in Justice League Europe, especially during this era where there's a lot of crossover between the two.
Mm-hmm.
That's how those extra numbers come in there. And Elrond, so Elrond, 34 appearances.
Good on you, Elrond. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, because we have the MangaCon two-parter to start with, but then we have the Justice League in Space, the Invasion of Apocalypse. He gets a few appearances that way. And then he's here, you know, in Justice League America right after Scott returns from space. So that's a good, you know, five, six issues before General Glory comes on the scene. It's easy to kind of see it because at least both General Glory and Elrond were both in the Justice League America book primarily. So, you know, that's their overlapping time there. But, oh, yeah, Elrond was in there quite a bit. They like the little guy.
So do you have the spreadsheet right in front of you?
I do.
If you can, just because, I mean, we are going a little bit long here. If you can, if you don't mind, rapid fire, if it's easily sortable and all that, I'd love to know the top 10 least appeared characters. I mean, guessing Shiloh's the number one, but okay. So no discussion, just rapid fire through them.
Okay. Do you want from lowest to highest?
Yeah,
highest
just the lowest. Let's do the lowest to highest. Yeah, so number one, then up to 10. Yep.
Okay, here we go.
Uh-huh.
Cat Matui.
Oh, Arisia, gosh. Okay.
Firestorm.
Uh-huh.
Beefeater.
Uh-huh.
Creeper.
All right.
The Mr. Miracle Robot.
Interesting.
Spectre.
Okay.
Aquaman.
Uh-huh.
Shiloh, Mr. Miracle.
Wow. Okay.
And Tasmanian Devil.
Shiloh got more appearances than Beefeater. Never would have imagined that. That's fascinating.
It was 5 versus 4.
Okay, so it was close. All right. Well, that's fun. Wow, what an incredible spreadsheet and what a great fun thing to do. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. That's awesome.
Oh, sure.
Tim.
Oh, it was. Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those. I'm a math guy. I'm a math guy. So it's a math guy thing to do.
All right, math guy. I got a question for you. Breakdowns has a very divisive reputation. You know, some folks love it. Some people don't. I'm not even sure anymore which one is the majority. I've gotten so mixed up in the carrying of this podcast. So when we look at this issue alone, does this issue stand out as saying, yeah, breakdowns should deserve a bad reputation, or is it better than some people remember?
That's a good question. And I would actually say this says that breakdowns, it should be remembered better. It tells a very compelling story. It has a very satisfying final battle between good and evil. Our heroes feel some consequences, and the storytelling is just spot on. The artwork is exemplary. In spite of our quibbles about the inking, it still just shines. And I just think it's great. I think it's a great issue.
I agree with you. I think it's a good one. I think you got real stakes. You get a real battle. You have a villain that was built up to be a real threat. You get a solid ending for him. You get a defeat or death or whatever that seems plausible. And it feels right because the right characters are the ones that do it. So, yeah, could someone argue that it should have been a team effort? Well, you could say it was a team effort. I mean, they all made it. They all tried at one point or another to go after him. So I enjoyed it very much. I think it was great. I think this does demonstrate that breakdowns is good. I mean, really, we've asked every issue if breakdowns deserve this reputation or not. And I think it was only two times that it came up, you know, falling short. And that was in the middle during that sort of transition wave between Bialya and figuring out the dealing with all the UN and all that stuff. So I think the vast majority of breakdowns is an absolute win.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just at the time the series suffered because of some of the quality issues, perhaps a little bit of the fatigue, and people were like, okay, this has been fun for a while, but I want to get back to the old stuff. And just making fun of it because it was successful, you know? People were poking shots at it because it was successful and as opposed to, you know, taking it for what it was. It also does make sense in the time. But, you know, when you look at it from a broader perspective and giving it some chance to compare and mull it over and just consider the whole part, the whole era of this part of the Justice League, Breakdowns fits really very nicely as a bookend for the series.
It does. It does. And like you said, living in the time, I mean, unfortunately, it's very hard to know what you're going through compared to what's coming. I mean, if you look at this versus what's coming, okay, this is pretty darn good. Also, it's hard to sustain the excitement, the enthusiasm, because, you know, even a popular sitcom, you know, after a few years, it's, you know, people start to take it for granted. Even if the writing is still at the top of its game, we've had that for 5 years. You know, it's not new anything to me anymore. So you don't appreciate it as much. And I think that's part of what happened here. People weren't appreciating it as much. And then people start talking smack about it for a number of years until they all wake up with formerly known as the Justice League and go, you know what? I forgot. JLI was really stinking good. So
I couldn't agree more.
All right, so now this is the part where we have to nominate our favorite moment from the issue. We're going to nominate the
One Punch Award.
Whether it's fantastic or shocking or dramatic or funny or just awe-inspiring or whatever, both myself and Tim will pick one moment and only one will be awarded the coveted One Punch Award. Tim, what is your suggestion, recommendation for this issue?
Oh, I thought it was that only one of our suggestions from each of us gets the award. So we each get an award because we're both winners. I thought that's
all. There are no participation trophies. Terribly sorry. So what do you got, buddy?
I'm just talking smack about my participation trophies, Dave. On the list. Anyway, so I'm going to go back. I've gushed about it already a little too much, but I can't help it. I may be colorblind, but I'm not stupid. Zark, as Silver Sorceress crushes the Dream Slayer on page 17. That moment just kicks butt. I love it.
Well, I will take back what I say because we're both going to win this time because we both picked the same moment. Yeah.
No.
It has to be.
That's great.
Silver Sorceress. I mean, for me, it's not just that one panel. It's that whole page. It's
true.
You know, her talking about it, him crushing him, her saying, and so it ends, and then her dying. I mean, that whole page, it's just beautiful. It tells the story. It's the triumph. And it's absolutely the winner. So, yes, we both get our participation trophies because
Yay.
Silver Sorceress has won the one Punch Award. So congratulations, Silver Sorceress. Wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for that moment.
Now, we could be Marvel style and still fight over the fact about whether it's just the one panel or the whole page, but maybe we won't do that. Maybe we won't take the Marvel homage that much.
We're going to fight during the commercial break. Don't worry. So, but before we do that, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit and sort of packing away all the Justice League Europe comic stuff for good? You know, shutting off the lights on the European embassies and bringing Justice League Europe to a close for me?
I can handle it. Let me just go get my back brace. I need that first. Strap it on for before I get to heavy lifting. Because how did Kilowog bring these daggum file cabinets in here in the first place and these computer systems? Jiminy criminy.
Right. Well, thank you, Tim. I appreciate that. And don't worry, folks. We will bring Tim back at the end of the show. And while Tim is shutting down Justice League Europe for us, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called
Justice Log.
But first, a little bit of news. The Justice League International Omnibus Volume 3 hardcover has been officially solicited, so it's a real deal now, folks. It's coming out May 14th, 2024. Page count's 1,448 pages. Cover price is going to be $150. Now, the exact contents inside the book are a little hard to pin down. Like, some of the solicits that I've seen do include the titles, but the more official solicits don't list any specific issues, so I don't know. These particular issues listed might be just some fan theory, or they could be the actual thing. So either way, this is what I'm hearing is going to be included in the omnibus. Without getting bogged down in specific numbers, it's the remaining issues of Justice League America and Justice League Europe written by Giffen and DeMatteis. Then you've got the Justice League International Special number 2. You've got those annuals as well. Then you get into Justice League Quarterly issues 2 through 5. And so that's the bulk of the Giffen DeMatteis era, right? Then supposedly it's going to include Green Lantern number 18. JLA 80-page giant number 1, which includes that mouse story by the original team, formerly known as the Justice League. I can't believe it's not the Justice League. And then the DC retroactive story from that there as well. And then Secret Origins number 33 through 35. So again, I can't tell you if those are all legit or just what someone is expecting. If they are legit, I'm pretty pleased that our podcast has covered almost every single thing that they just listed there. We covered the Green Lantern issue recently. We covered all the Justice League quarterlies. Well, we didn't cover number 5, but that's specifically because it didn't have any Giffen DeMatteis in it. We're going to be covering the JLA 80-page giant mouse story. We're going to be covering formerly known as the Justice League. We're going to be covering, I can't believe it's not the Justice League, and we'll be covering the DC retroactive story about the Injustice League as well. So they're really the only big missing piece that's in the omnibus that we didn't cover in this podcast podcast was Secret Origins number 33 through 35, and that was intentional, because when I started this podcast, Ryan Daly was doing the Secret Origins podcast on our same network and covered those issues. So I feel like they were a companion piece at the time. So I do recommend, if you want to experience those Secret Origins stories, go back to our Secret Origins podcast with Ryan Daly and listen to those episodes. All right, one other thing. This isn't necessarily news, but it's something fun I did. Over on Patreon, I ran a poll for our patrons, asking them who are their two favorite JLI artists. And I specified two, because I was pretty sure if I just asked for one, Kevin McGuire would just easily win. So, as suspected, I got a lot of comments about how hard it was to pick people's two favorite artists. Like, one was easy, two was hard. There was a little bit of trouble with the polling as far as certain people on, like, Droids had trouble with some of the polls, so they left comments on what they would have picked. So I downloaded the votes, I adjusted the voting based on the problems that people mentioned in the comments, and so here we go. There's a total of 39 votes. Kevin McGuire had 45% of the vote, so he was the clear winner as the favorite artist. Then the second favorite artist was Adam Hughes with 34% of the vote. They were by far the lead runners. Then pulling up behind that would be Ty Templeton with only 8% of the vote, and then Bart Sears and Derek Robertson tied for about 5% of the vote, and one person surprisingly voted for Chris Wozniak. So, hey, good on you, man. I'm happy people enjoy the stuff they enjoy. And then sorry to Linda Medley and Marshall Rogers, and sadly did not receive any votes. Now, there were a few comments about why Mike McCone and Keith Giffen were missing from the poll. Well, folks, they were never regular pencilers on the book. They filled in quite a bit from here and there in different places, but they were never regular ongoing artists on the book. So remember, folks, get out on the social media. As I always say, it's about building an online community of fans around this podcast, fans of the JLI specifically. So hit us up. You know all the places, Twitter, Facebook, Blue Sky, all those places. Remember, when you're posting comments on our website, please be sure to let me know if you're outside the United States, and I will assign you the appropriate embassy. So I'm going to be pulling your comments for this time from our website, email, social media, just pulling bits and pieces because there's so much feedback here. And we're going to be covering the most recent episode featuring Justice League America number 58 with my guests Jake and Warren, and Justice League Europe number 34 with my guest Symbol Pending. Also, last episode, I encourage folks to share in the comments section their memories and thoughts about Keith Giffen and his career and their favorite comments. So I will be reading some of that as we go through the feedback. First up is John Coos from the Quintessential Gen X 80s podcast with John and Scott. He is a massive Power Girl fan, and there's been an ongoing rivalry between him and Symbol Pending. So with Symbol Pending on the show, John says, "I announce that I submit Symbol Pending is the greatest Power Girl fan of all time. It's not simply because his moniker is actually Symbol Pending. It's not that he's devoted years to a blog about Power Girl. It's for one simple reason. Anyone that is forgiving about the current Leah Williams run of Power Girl is definitely the greatest Kara Zor-El fan ever. I will adjust my claim as the greatest Power Girl fan to the greatest sane Power Girl fan ever." And Symbol Pending received the teasing in good humor, and great on that, John and Symbol, building bridges, finding ways to get along and enough space for all fans to be fans of Power Girl. Then we heard from Everton Vieira do Carmo from our Brazil embassy. He says, "I have to say I read this league's era in 3 months in college in 2017. And there are a few moments that live rent-free in my mind from breakdowns. Guy asking Metamorpho, where is Captain Atom when he was just declared dead? For me, this was an even bigger act of being a jerk than hitting Blue Beetle. General Glory not wanting to give a speech. And then there's a few others that I don't want to spoil because they're in the epilogue. But Ted saving the day is the moment I didn't know I was waiting for. Remembering that he single-handedly defeated a villain that the European League couldn't beat together. It's Blue Beetle for the win." Yeah, that was a great moment, wasn't it, Everton? So glad. Then we're from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and other stories. Rob says, "My favorite Keith Giffen story is the 2005 Defenders. It explains why Doctor Strange likes the Submariner. And heavens, if you look at the Submariner, you better explain why someone likes him." Then we hear from Chris Lewis from the England embassy. Chris says, "For my own part, my favorite non-JLI Giffen series is The Heckler, an all-too-short 6 issues of wisecracking Looney Tunes fun merged with a hitherto unexplored corner of the DCU. I also want to shout out an unsung role that Mr. Giffen played coordinating the masterwork that was the groundbreaking Weekly 52 series. Keith was the glue that held that incredible achievement together, a feat that only a true comics professional could pull off." I totally agree, Chris. 52 was amazing. And yeah, a lot of that, it got to be down to Keith Giffen helping to spearhead that comic. They were from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. And he says, another great episode and guests, wow, from South Africa. Yeah, that was pretty exciting, Bucky. Yeah, so glad to have them on the show. Then we're from Josh Romano, who says, hey, Shag, another great show with great guests. Congratulations on filling your continent bingo card. I absolutely agree with your logic on Antarctica. Well, thank you, Josh. I appreciate that. Some people did not agree with my logic on my Antarctica choice, but you know what? It's my show. So there we go. Anyway, continuing on, Josh says, I am hoping you'll continue to make episodes about the post-breakdown miniseries that reunited these characters as the Super Buddies. I'll be sad to see the podcast complete the run and fade into the sunset over the secret sanctuary in New Jersey or Rhode Island or whatever it actually is. That was a great callback, Josh. I like that. Now, as you heard me just say a few minutes ago, yes, I'm going to be covering all those fantastic things. I read them at the beginning here of the Justice Log, so you guys know what's on the horizon. And there's a few other things I'm going to be touching on as well. So stay tuned for that. And again, we'll be going through August, so we got great content all the way till the end. Then we heard from Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast. He's from our Australian embassy, and he continues to chime in with absolutely meaningless things, such as saying, weird, I always thought that I was the Power Girl fan. Symbol Pending from our England embassy, who does the Symbol Pending Power Girl blog, and also the guest last episode, was nice enough to chime in and say, hey, Paul, there's room enough for everyone to be a Power Girl fan. Aw, that was very nice of you, Symbol Pending. Then Symbol Pending goes on to say specifically about the issues we covered last month, while I'm also generally not a fan of extended fight scenes, Justice League America number 58 gets away with it by sprinkling in little moments with characters. Personally, I really like the moments with B flying above the underwater fight and not being able to help due to the nature of her powers. It's rare we get any introspection from the characters, so it's a welcome change. Yeah, that was a great moment with her. I totally agree, Symbol Pending. Then we heard from Craig McDonald, says, it's been said countless times, but the artwork on these books is still amazing years later. This is one of my favorite Justice League stories. The right blend of action, humor, danger, and heart. Then we're from Gus Casals from our Argentina embassy. He hosts podcasts such as Ian Reed's Crisis and Alfred Pennyworth Presents Podcast and more. Gus says, for me, Keith was comics. My favorite creator from my favorite era. I like many creators. I love Keith. He was and always will be the one. And I have so many feelings that I did a video on him a couple of years back. I have a whole podcast dedicated to his 5 years later Legion and recently guested on an impromptu homage with a few fellow local podcasters. And I'll probably go on paying him my respects while I can. As for the show, Bart Sears. Wow, that was a breath of fresh air, and a thrill to see him doing the JLA characters, and his guy Gardner is unbeatable, and who would have guessed the pathos would come from Elrond? Some great thoughts on Keith, Gus. Thank you for sharing those. And yeah, absolutely, Bart was amazing. Then we're from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novel Monster Problems, Super Problems, and Time Problems. Just picking and choosing like some bits here that I'm doing with everyone. Jason writes, Mr. Giffen leaves a legacy of entertainment that will never be forgotten and made an indelible impact. All these years later and people are still talking about JLI. How many comic book runs can we say that about? His work brought so much joy to myself and my family growing up. Some of you know that when I was a kid, I collected comics with my dad, and I can tell you my dad was talking about and quoting Manga Khan, Scarlet's Gear, Elrond, Maxwell Lord, and the Injustice League, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold, Guy Gardner, etc., right up through the 2010s and until he passed away in 2018. Mr. Geffen leaves a legacy of joy, and how many people can say that? He will be missed. Oh, you're absolutely right, Jason. Then about the issues themselves, Jason goes on to say, I too am disappointed at the Injustice League fling. A lot of work's been done to move these guys from has-been villains to at least nominal heroes. I never thought about this being the last time we will see this iteration of the Injustice League, and that is sad. From there on out, they either get ignored, killed off, or turned grim and gritty. Yeah, but we do get that one more retroactive story, so I'm looking forward to reading that, but yeah. Then he says, overall, the conglomerate is a neat concept that didn't get a chance, and I wonder if the hope after Justice League Quarterly number 1 was for a spin-off series starring them, led by Booster, but it never happened. If Giffen and DeMatteis had a longer JLI run, would the conglomerate gotten featured more? Yeah, I mean, these are all great questions. I do wonder about the conglomerate. I mean, there was such an effort to promote them, and then it was just over. So it does seem strange, like maybe there was some plan that just never came to fruition. I'm just not sure. Then from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel, Liz says, sorry to hear about Keith Giffen dying. He was a great artist and writer. I liked his work for years. My favorite was Pung X. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be like pun, like a joke, and then X, or it's punks. I didn't read it. But either way, Liz says, my favorite, though, was Pung X. Don't ask, I have issues. And Ambush Bug, whom was ever more popular than Lobo at one time. And then Liz says, about the issues themselves, says, of course the true hero, Beefeater, is there to save the day. I always love the Beefeater fans. That's awesome. Then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. I don't know who this guy is. He just keeps showing up. But either way, Tim says, JLA number 58, thank goodness Bart Sears is back. He just swoops in near the end to save the day. And boy, howdy, did he deliver this issue. That fight sequence on page 16 with Despero pounding Jean is one of my favorite dynamic sequences in comics. I feel the hits every time. And Guy's face after the pounding by Lobo, still trying to stay in the game, is just fantastic. And honestly, one of Guy's best hero moments. Then Tip says another great hero moment is Dimitri. I've long been his biggest supporter, and I'm sadly he hasn't got much to shine in Breakdown so far. But here, against Despero, leading him away from the city and taking the brunt of his attack says it all. Yes, he has that powerful armor, but he's just an ordinary man underneath it. As John said, and I support him, Dimitri's the best of them. For Justice League Europe number 34, while it wasn't said in the story, I appreciate Booster having a chance to fight Despero, as he missed the previous big battle, which led to the death of Mr. Miracle, one of Booster's close friends. This gives him a chance to redeem himself for missing the first fight. It also fits with him getting so emotional during the fight this issue. Then about Keith Giffen, Tim writes, the first time I saw his art was browsing the pre-crisis issue of Action Comics where Ambush Bug swapped bodies with Superman, was thinking, huh, this is odd. And then I browsed the Ambush Bug miniseries. His work was starting to intrigue me, but money was a little tight, so I didn't pull the trigger. And then came Justice League number one. Now I couldn't get enough of Giffen, either as a writer or artist. Then Tim goes on to say, I was lucky enough to meet Keith at HeroesCon a few years ago. He signed some of my comics, especially JLI, of course, and was just as funny and cranky as you'd expect. His blunt, quote, they kicked me off the Legion, so I blew up the Earth, and a panel was hilarious. And I'm so glad I had the chance to tell him that JLI is my favorite superhero comic series. Then we heard from Captain Entropy, who says, Shag, terrific new guests on what looks like great issues. I didn't have these, so it felt like friends telling me about a great comic they read. Symbol Penning, that was an excellent podcast debut. You were funny, and you gave Shag a hard time. You brought the good insights, and you kept moving. Jake and Warren, all the same to you, and I got the impression you're old pros. Aw, that was nice of you to say to them, Captain Entropy. Then he says, regarding Keith Giffen's passing, I keep thinking of JLA number 50, which featured Keith and several other creators in the second story in our discussion of them on the podcast. The story portrayed Keith as a little crazy, dramatically expressing strong opinions over everything that had to do with the JLI. If I remember right, you asked if I'd ever met Keith or heard him in an interview, and I admitted I'd only ever enjoyed his work. You told me, well, he's really a lot like this. So this parody is even funnier when I knew it was only a slight exaggeration, and I'm glad he felt so strongly about his work. Oh, that's great insight, Captain Entropy. Yeah, and that, you know, in hindsight, yeah, that JLA number 50 funny backup story is a lot more meaningful now, isn't it? They were from Martin Gray from the Scotland Embassy, and he does the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. Martin says, thanks for another splendid episode, and yet more fresh guests, all of whom were splendid. Yeah, they really were, weren't they? So nice, and thank you everybody, by the way, the compliments for the guests, because they're really great, and I know they love to hear this kind of stuff. You know, it's scary being on a podcast for the first time, and then getting this wonderful kind of feedback from y'all, the listeners, is really awesome. So my thanks to you guys on behalf of the people who were on the show. All right, then Martin says, the one thing I really don't like about Bart Sears' JLA art is Catherine Cobert's hair. That crown of hair is huge, as she looks like the love child of Coriander and Hector Hammond. Well, Martin, two sides of that. A, you're not wrong. And B, I love it anyway. There's just something about the way Bart Sears draws Catherine that I love. So, hey, you know what? Different strokes, I guess? I don't know. Then Martin says, many thanks for the kind word, Symbol Penning. It was such fun to work on this old DC reprint. Yeah, Martin, so many of our friends across the pond owe you a huge debt of gratitude. Up next is Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network. He has the Martian Manhunter Idlehead of Diablo blog and podcast. And now, folks, this is where we see the opposite end of the Find Your Joy spectrum. Frank has very different opinions than some other people. And you know what? Hey, his feelings are just as valid as everyone else's. Let's see. About Bart Sears, he says, Breakdowns is interminable and needed some flashy spectacle at this point. Bart Sears' Lobo is a bit too clean for me, and his Despero looks a bit puffy, but these pages are the Sistine Chapel in comparison to Wazzy. Then he poses the question, wait, did we ever sort out who shot Maxwell Lord? Was it Bialya, the Queen Bee? You know, Frank, that's a great question to ask, because you're right, they never explicitly said who shot Maxwell Lord. But they made it pretty clear that it was either Jack-O-Lantern, who was working for Harjavati, or it was someone else that worked for Harjavati. But either way, General Colonel or whatever it was, Harjavati, the brother, clearly was responsible for the shooting of Maxwell Lord. They never explicitly put it out there, so that's a good point. Then Frank says, back in the 1980s, a lot of comics made hay about ankle-biting yellow journalism attacking heroes for ratings. Today, John Oliver would do an episode on how Manga Con is not an effective alternative to formal incarceration, and we'd be like, yeah, what about that, JLI? That's a good point, yeah. Them continually handing over bad guys to Manga Con is not the best plan. Then Frank says, possibly the most humiliating moment in Martian Manhunter's career, and he's had quite a few, is being saved from immolation by the conglomerate. Never mind that Booster Gold told should be serving time at that moment for embezzlement, but the rest? Without a display of powers, these clowns might as well be the Guardian Angels. What are they going to do, escort Despero back to the turnstile to make him pay for the subway token? And he says, meanwhile, Blue Beetle steals from Kitty Pryde's theft from Ellen Ripley to fry the bad guys in jet flames. And he says, here's an idea. Maybe melt the extremists to slag right after you beat them the first time. Then Frank says, before Shag asked if these breakdowns chapters deserve their bad rep, he should have prefaced with the, quote, and remember, the conglomerate are in these issues, end quote. Cue the Imperial thumbs down. How did I like these issues? Well, I quit buying breakdowns with chapter 12 of 15. I was 80% through, and these issues were admittedly an uptick, but still went, nah, I'm good, knowing full well that I was still buying JLA number 60. So, reputation well earned. Hey, you know what, Frank? I appreciate your insight. Obviously, I don't feel the same, but dude, I love hearing from you, buddy. Then we heard from Doug Adamson, just picking some of the things he said. He says, so let's start off with these excellent guests in the episode. It was great to hear new voices and new accents as well. Jake and Warren were an excellent double act and certainly dedicated and great ambassadors for the South African JLI fans. As for Symbol Pending, it was so nice to finally be able to put a voice to the name I've seen so many times online and, of course, in the comment section here. I believe this was Symbol Pending's first podcast appearance, and he was brilliant. Then going on about breakdowns, Doug says, at the time, I felt it was almost too much to have so many serious threats to deal with at the same time. Lobo, Despero, the extremists. That's not how comic teams normally work. It's face one threat and then the next, not all at the same time, unless it's a villain team up. Now, with 48 years experience, I realize this is exactly how life goes. Lots of things happen at the same time, and it's juggling act just to keep things going. Far less dealing with the biggest threats. Then about the JLE issue, he says the art sings. The Lobo Booster head-to-head, Power Girl in the cave, Beetle dropping off Booster, and these last pages of Max. All of them look fantastic and really in the tradition of the facial expressions of JLI. Also, I'd argue that Derek Robertson has drawn the best Power Girl in and of the books. I do like that costume, but she looks great and more athletic than a powerlifter style. All right, then moving on to his thoughts on Keith Giffen. He says Keith could change his art style almost instantly was another amazing talent he had. I honestly can't recall a single penciler who you can say has had so many different periods of his work, and most of them were fantastic. However, it wasn't his art, it was his stories that I loved, and I followed his work almost everywhere he went with DC. From the main DCU to Heckler and to Vexed and back to the DCU and even into the New 52. As the comic industry stands to grind to a halt in terms of sales of new books and whatnot, all I can think that is of the way Keith Giffen was a driving force like no other to bring great ideas into the books and universes he worked on, and probably more than almost everyone brought the greatest years of DC together. If he had only done Legion of Superheroes, he would have been a legend. If he had only done JLI, the same thing. But he did both, and far, far more than that. Great thoughts, Doug. Then we heard from Damian Drew A. Whiter from the England Embassy in the Should I Love This Comic podcast. Damian says, I discovered DC Comics with the Millennium Crossover. I went home with my first 16 DC comics, including JLI number 9 and 10. I adored those two comics. Everything about them felt fresh and different. The characters were completely defined in those issues. I read them again and again, and I became a Keith Giffen fan for life. Keith's expressive art in those two issues featured backups, penciled by Keith Giffen, and it was these stories that fascinated me. It's really difficult to express why an art style appeals. There was something in the abstraction of those huge black splotches that sang to me, and I wanted more. Then he says, over the succeeding 35 years, I've continued to love Keith's work and have continued to pick it up. It's weird how attached you can feel to a person you've never met, but also, how can you not feel a connection when someone's creativity brings you joy for decades? I feel a genuine loss. Then Damian went on to recommend a whole bunch of books from Keith that he just thought were worth revisiting, and I will co-sign almost all of those. The only ones that I don't co-sign are just simply because I haven't read them, but great choices. And then last long comment we're going to hit on is Chris Pine. Specific to the issues, he says, that was a fun podcast to listen to. All the different viewpoints and new voices joining you to cover these issues really had me sit back and take a moment to appreciate how packed Breakdowns is with characters. And then he says, I keep hearing a criticism about how Breakdowns doesn't have any stakes. For my money, Breakdowns has plenty of stakes. Max not being in control of his body, the change of leadership in Bialya, the JLI losing its charter, Elrond leaving, hell, Ted having to figure out how to overcome an eating disorder. These are all stakes. Some may be small human consequences, but they can still hold weight. In that sense, that's what this entire Given Demetrius run has been about. The humanity of these characters in between the action that they capture with humor, friendships, romances, arguments, money problems, and sometimes failed gambling resorts. And then Chris Pine shares a lot of thoughts about Keith Giffen, and a lot of this really resonated with me, so I'm going to read a big chunk of this. So Chris says, if I'm being honest, I was not a fan of Giffen at the beginning. His art was weird. The storytelling was dense and funky. And those packed nine-panel grids and close-ups of the characters' teeth? Everyone with large foreheads and gangly arms and long torsos? I didn't get it. And sometimes his writing was even harder to get through. He was always world building. You felt like you were always jumping in the middle of some larger story he had been writing for decades and you missed something. A Giffen book required you to pay attention. And I didn't want to pay attention. I wanted splash pages and fights and straightforward plot. It was just frustrating to find a random issue in a series I was collecting that he was attached to because I knew I wasn't getting an easy book to read. And then something clicked. Suddenly, the art wasn't dense and weird. It was interesting and it had texture to it. It was bold and creative. His writing suddenly made sense. The pacing of the 9-panel grid seemed obvious. It was storytelling at its best. I just had to slow down and give myself time to adjust to his gear. And when I did, it opened up a wonderful, beautiful, frightening, satirical, cranky, and sometimes infuriating world of adventures that I didn't always do what you expected them to do. And then, when I felt like it had it all figured out, he'd change it up again and come at you from a different angle, and I had to learn his language all over again. Giffen's work was everywhere in my comic collecting heyday, and I don't think there's a book he didn't touch at one point or another, and he gave us every kind of story you'd want. It's a weird feeling to see the people whose work you grew up with pass away. Keith Giffen was an institution, creating comics before I bought my first one and after I got my last. And while he may no longer be with us to be able to give us new adventures moving forward, there's so many books out there with his name attached that are just waiting to be picked up, dusted off, and rediscovered over and over again. Keith Giffen will entertain, challenge, and frustrate fans for a very long time. And that sounds like something he'd be okay with. Wow, Chris, that was great. And I want to say everybody's comments in the comment thread was amazing and powerful and thought-provoking. And I just want to end it on that one for the bulk of the comments because it felt like it was echoing a lot of what all of us were saying. So thanks to you, Chris. And then now we're going to be moving on to a lot of the more rapid-fire stuff. So first up, Double Stuff Award is going to Brett Young. You may remember Brett from the Imagine 8 Design. He is our doily fan. He did another drawing. This time he did Despero blasting a tablecloth with his third eye powers, and he's adorned wearing, instead of like a loincloth, he's wearing a doily, and he's carrying a doily, and he says, "No tablecloths, only doilies. There are more decorative and provide a better household aesthetic. Behold the fine craftsmanship and despair." It is amazing. I'll include it in the image gallery. Thank you so much, Brett. I absolutely love this thing. Then I'll just rapid fire. We got some nice comments from Siskoid, who surprisingly was making fun of me. Don Lindbergh said, "Great episode." Then Superman Radio Revisited said they also enjoyed the episode's cover art. So thank you for that. I appreciate that. Superman Raider Visited. I love doing those cover images. And then Crazy Joe Adventures is working his way through our back catalog and leaving comments on Twitter. He will hear this eventually. And when you do, glad to have you, Joe. All right, then now is the time where we're going to thank everyone who shared the show on their social media timeline. We're talking about Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. Long list of names. However, these folks really showed their support and helped promote the show. So again, it's always important to me to thank these people and recognize them because it's the only time they're going to mention the show, a lot of them, but they are part of the family. They are helping to spread the word. And you can be on this list too, folks. All you got to do is Facebook, Twitter, or Blue Sky, reshare the JLI posts, and I'll be happy to add you to the list. So our thanks go out to Al Girding, Andre Lima, Andre TFG, Batman, the Animated Series Reunion, Bill, a.k.a. the Batpod, the Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook group, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Chris Pine, Christopher Luke, Coffee and Comics, Damian Drew A. Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Days of High Adventure Podcast, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Doug Adamson, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Frederico Hernandez, Gus Casals, Jake Muir, J.P. Roca, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker, Kirby at Here's Kirby, Con L, Crazy Joe Adventures, Liz Ann Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matthew Cody, Max Romero, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mike Dinas, Mr. Tommy G, Mo Walker, Nathaniel Devon Mason Stanford, Norman Wins, Paul Kinn, Pragmatic Gollum, Rob Kelly, Rolled Spine Podcast, Samantha Levine, Scott X, Sean Ross, Siskoid, Slangword Scott, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Voice of Paul, Tim Price, Turbo Comics, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Willie Yarborough, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew. Again, everyone, thank you so much for your support of the JLI podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, folks. I mean, I get emotional thinking about the fact that I'm not going to be doing feedback a year from now and for this show. And it makes me sad because I love working with all you folks. I feel like it's a big team. So thank you to everyone who leaves feedback or retweets the show or any of that stuff. I really appreciate it. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Jake Warner, Symbol Pending. If we did miss you, just let me know, and I'll be sure to include you in the next episode. And keep those cards and letters coming, folks. Visit our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave a comment on the show post there. Over on Facebook, you can find us as JLI Podcast or Just League International Blahaha Podcast. On Twitter, it's JLI Podcast. On Blue Sky, we're under FW Podcast. You can email us at JLIPodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Jack, Warren, and Symbol Pending for appearing on the most recent episode of the show, and my thanks to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, I will tell you, folks, what you don't know is this feedback section took an incredibly long time to prepare and record. First of all, going through all of your comments about Keith Giffen was very emotional and moving and powerful, and it took time to decide just which pieces to read. And then I'm sick, and so I have had to edit and re-record and tweak and cut and make so many changes while I'm recording this segment. It has been a nightmare. So thank you for sticking with me, and I hope it all came together in some semblance of something you can listen to. All right, now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we are going to see if we can bring our guests from this episode, Mark Baker Wright and Tim Price, together in the same embassy.
Batman wouldn't help them, so now the team's on their own. Black Lightning, Geo-Force, Halo, Katana, Looker, Metamorpho. People of power with a new purpose. They are the Outsiders.
The Outcasters continues its coverage of the Outsiders, and Mike W. Barr's team for the 80s has big changes on the way, with a new home, a new title, and coming soon, the Baxter series. You can find the show on Right On Network with your favorite podcatcher, or listen at thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at @BatOutcasters. Because to live outside the law or on Twitter, you must be honest.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, it does appear the JLI teleporter has brought both Mark and Tim together for us. Now, Mark, after all these years, it is so exciting to be able to record a podcast with you, finally, and I can check it off my bucket list. I don't ever have to do it again. would you please tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
Well, you can find my blog at Blackrock's Toy Box. That's blackrockstoybox.blogspot.com. It's a little out of date now, but it's where you can find all of the archived episodes of the podcast that I did a couple of years ago with my brother Nick on the Transformers Generation 2 comic. The podcast is called Not Your Father's Autobot. You can also find me at Blue Sky Social at gbblackrock.bluesky.social. GB Blackrock is also my screen name on a bunch of the Transformers message boards, especially if you go to the AllSpark or TFW 2005. You can find me there.
Awesome. Well, again, Mark, thank you so much for being here. It's been an absolute blast. I still can't believe that in all these years we never talked about Firestorm. We'll have to find a time to talk about Firestorm at some point, but thank you so much for being here.
I can give you the dissertation on everything Shadowstorm.
I know you can, and I want to hear it. Tim, my good friend, this is, I believe, your third appearance on the show. It's been an absolute joy to have you back on the show. Would you please tell the listeners where they can find you out on the internets?
I think I will, because that's the kind of guy I am. And the kind of guy you are, having me back on the show always makes me so happy. You know, this is the first podcast I ever listened to. Not comic book podcast, any podcast.
Wow.
And I've said that before, and I want to give it the props, because this got me into listening to podcasts and then into podcasting and meeting all the great people that have become my friends since then, especially you, my bud. So.
Aww.
This is home for me. And as I've said, this series is one of my favorite comic book series of all time. It is definitely my favorite superhero comic book series of all time. So I am so grateful to be on here when you're getting near the end, because getting near the end of this last issue, the upcoming issue, we didn't know we were going to get anything else in the future. We had no idea. Mm. We couldn't assume that. And just having what we did was just fantastic and phenomenal. And I just love to revisit it. So I'm just so glad that you did this show, and congratulations on making it this far. And I'm definitely hanging in here all the way to the end of your coverage, and looking forward to every minute of it. But thank you for having me on again. And let's see. So now that I've gotten the mushy stuff out of the way, where you can find me? You can find me on the internets. If you look for Tim Price 17, you'll find me basically on lots of social medias, whether it be Twitter or Blue Sky or Threads or Mastodon or Counter Social. It's Tim Price 17 on all of those. You also can find my podcast efforts on the Right On Network. Our website is thehuntresspodcast.com. That's our big show on that network covering Helena Wayne and Helena Bertinelli. I'm not on that show very much, but I am on the other shows there, such as the Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast and my show, The Outcasters of Batman, The Outsiders podcast. You can find that show also on Twitter at BatOutcasters. And yeah, you also can find my vocal stylings occasionally on ATW, Akadekaganagon Theater Works, where we do various radio-style productions, especially the Strangers in Paradise adaptation, which has been a lot of fun to work on, and there's so many great voice actors with that group. I feel very proud to be included among them. You can find their shows on the Two True Freaks podcast network. And yeah, I think that's my things.
That's a lot of stuff, and all great stuff. So, folks, please definitely go out there and check out all those things Tim just mentioned. The Right On Network, I love everybody over there. I feel like I'm getting to know AJ a little better. I feel like I'm getting to get Laurel a little bit better. I know you, obviously, so I adore the whole gang over there, getting to know April. It's a fantastic set of shows over there. And then all the other stuff you're working on, too. It's just amazing. And Outcasters, I mean, come on, man. Somebody had to do a Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and I'm so glad it was you. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, all my compatriots, my pod cousins at Right On Network are fantastic people, and I can't believe AJ's still putting up with me after all this time. It's been great. and I gotta say, I do take a little too much pleasure out of the friendly rivalry between you and Paul Hicks over the Straight Out of the Federation. I'm not encouraging this rivalry, but it is entertaining.
To be fair, I did steal your phone to use a plug to get me on the show. So
this is also true.
Thank you again, Tim, for being on the show. And I knew when I was planning out the last run of the show that I was not going to let the show finish without having you one more time. I had to have you on the show. So
thank you.
All right, buddy. Well, folks, that is going to do it. Now, come back next episode when we cover just one comic, Justice League America number 60, the final issue in the original Giffen DeMatteis run. Unbelievable. We're finally here. It's just shocking. And we'll have a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. By now, I'm pretty sure you figured out how this works. You're going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Mark.
And I'm Tim.
And you've been listening to the JLI podcast.
Want to make something of it?